2018 was the beginning. From podcasts to live events, Fight Night Picks was off and running.
Do you typically train for a fight with a specific game plan in mind, or do you train for a certain opponent?
Honest to God, I always have the same game plan.
A year later, a new ad.
The cringe fest continues with Henry Cejudo. He pulled out a snake today. Old clip.
Since then, it's been a wild ride. 2022 shaping up to be another crazy year.
Chandler, he might be peacocking right now. I think that left hook.
Whoa! Peacock right
hand,
Michael Chandler.
Oh, they've both been hurt this.
Oh!
So as they say, let's get into it.
And back to the grind. And thanks so much for joining us. As always, one half your host to do it, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen on the respective socials. And this week, we're looking forward to UFC Fight Night Hermanson versus Strickland. And it's one of those cards where plenty of prospects, four UFC debuts, and very experienced fighters at that. The former Bellator main eventer, he did that three times. A couple co-main events too, Chidi and Njoku Wani. And you've got a couple of big-time bangers up in the middleweight division in your main event, ranked top. And right after him, you have Hermanson taking on Strickland. And this is one of those cards that I think will probably fly under the radar. But I know we're really excited about a lot of the matchups here.
I like this card because it doesn't reach these crazy, incredible heights that some pay-per-views do. But I don't think there's a single massive stinker on the fight card. Like, okay, maybe Sam Alvey versus Phil Haas isn't pay-per-view worthy on a lot of cards. But this is just a consistent card throughout. And I think that's something we can all look forward to. And the main event's a fun one, too, because it's two guys who have had main event opportunities before in the past, so we kind of know quite a bit about Sean Strickland and Jack Hermanson. These aren't two new fighters who are just getting this one big opportunity, and I think it will be a great fight too, because with Hermanson, like I said, he had been at the top of the division, had a couple losses, but he rebounded, looked great against Edmund Shabazian his last time out. For Strickland, it's just been this really great string of fights up at the middleweight division, and this will be an interesting fight because he got a primary striker the last time out against Uriah Hall, passed that test with flying colors, so this should be an interesting one against definitely a good striker, but way more of a grappler, Jack Hermanson.
Big time opportunity for the former King of the Cage middleweight champ, Sean Strickland. The nickname's Tarzan. Matt's talking about passing tests with flying carpets. We also have Nick Maximov taking on Punahele Soriano. Rickyism in that co-main event should be a great one. And of course, the Ultimate Fighter Season 29 Finale 2.0, Trayshawn Gore taking on Brian Battle. Now, let's throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen. And as always, we ask you, the fans, to let us know down below in the comment section who you have as a possible pick for Fight of the Night. Because there's no wrong answers when you start at the start of the week before the fight card. So we'll throw it on over to the Fight of the Night screen, as always, presented by Manscaped. Make sure you check them out. Manscaped.com. Use the promo code FNP. You'll get 20% off and free shipping that Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
When we're talking about a possible fight of the night on this card, coming up this weekend in the featherweight division, we have a former Ultimate Fighter winner in Mike Trezano taking on Mean Hakeem Dawodu, the Canadian representing Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And for the Canadian, Hakeem Dawodu, yeah, he's had a couple of setbacks in the UFC. He had that loss in his debut against Danny Henry, and then he lost his last fight against Movsar Evloev. But he's taking on a willing and ready striker, and that's right in his wheelhouse against Trezano. I think this is going to be an all-action fight.
I think this should be a great fight. Couple guys who have lost, but I don't feel like the UFC's completely given up on them. Like you said, Dawodu had a really bad UFC debut, had a loss his last time out, but personally, I don't feel like he's out of sort of the top 15 picture, and I do feel like with an impressive win over Trezano, he could get himself back into sort of the rankings, or at least close to the rankings. And with Trezano, he's always adding something new to his game, which is always very exciting. So I think this should be a great fight.
And with our second pick, we said it from the top, but the Ultimate Fighter Season 29 Finale, Trayshawn Gore out due to a knee injury, in steps Gilbert Urbina, and a great fight against Brian Battle, who kind of withstood the early adversity, was able to get the rear naked choke finish in that fight. Now he gets to take on Trayshawn Gore. So Team Volkanovski versus Team Ortega. But these two guys bring unique skill sets into this octagon.
I'm so happy that we are actually getting this fight because this should have been the finale. So it is nice that the UFC finally like put something together that I think we can all agree on. But it's nice that Gore is kind of getting his opportunity to kind of fight for the Ultimate Fighter Championship, because I'm sure to him, if he wins this fight, it'll feel like he gets the title that he wasn't able to actually fight for. But with Brian Battle, like you said, looked great his last time out to win the Ultimate Fighter title. And he did face adversity, but that's always a good thing. thing for a young guy to face, so I think this should be a phenomenal fight.
Big time fights coming up this weekend. Make sure you check out the sponsor of the Fight of the Night screen, Manscaped, at manscaped.com. Use the promo code FMP. You get 20% off and free shipping. Big card coming up this weekend. And this is the week it's finally going to happen with Fight Night Picks. We're looking for 30K subscribers, and we are so damn close to hitting that goal. If we hit it, you unlock Dana White's Contender Series previews for this summer when that show comes back, and I can't wait for it. But listen, maybe I'll have a little bit of a special surprise if we hit that 30K subs. I mean, listen, today being Sunday, getting ready for this, we had a nor'easter before we got set and ready. So before I did my notes, I'll throw the picture up there. My face was frozen snow blowing this morning. We got a, 30, 40 centimeters of snow last night. It was absolutely insane. But I spent the bulk of the day getting ready for this card and this weekend because, listen, if you know anything about Fight Night Picks and you've been tuned in for long enough, or you've been hovering over that sub button, we're all about showcasing and highlighting those prospects and really getting into the in-depth conversations about them. And when I look at this card top to bottom, we mentioned it, there's a lot of them. But for me, Denis Bondar making a debut, I was so excited for him to come out last year. But unfortunately, three fights are canceled for him. You also have a big-time debut from Jailton Almeida. That should be a huge one, Matt. What's one of those fights that's kind of sleeping or it's under the radar that a lot of people might not be focusing on?
I think Marc-Andre Barrio versus Chidi Njokuwani is a phenomenal fight because with a lot of guys making their UFC debut, you don't really know how to match them up, especially someone coming from another organization where they weren't champion, but they definitely had quite a bit of, I guess, stock in the organization or at least somewhat pull. So it will be nice to see how he does, because I do think Power Bar, he's a good entry-level guy for Njokuwani, because he's not just some guy coming off Contender Series, but he's not somebody in the top 15. I think it's a great test for Njokuwani.
Should be a great fight and a big-time card. You're not going to want to miss any of it. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Flyweight never die, and that was something that at Fight Night Picks we had to say all the time, 2018, 19, 20, because the division seemed to be on the way out. Now all of a sudden, it's popping. It's the hottest division in the game, or at least one of them. I mean, Figueiredo, Moreno, we're going to get a fourth iteration of that. But coming up this weekend, we have a guy who beat the other Figueiredo. We have Malcolm Gordon taking on Ukraine's psycho, Denis Bondar, and I absolutely love this fight because for Bondar, we were expecting his debut not once, not twice, three times sold last year. And yes, he was originally supposed to take on Malcolm Gordon back in November. But before that, he drew Victor Rodriguez. He fell out of that fight. He drew Oday Osborne. We had a full prediction video for that fight. We were super excited about it. But ultimately now, he gets to spend a year on the shelf taking on Toronto top team's own Malcolm X Gordon. And for Malcolm Gordon, he has a very interesting background in MMA because you watch him fight, and when he blitzes forward, he has a lot of success with his striking. But some fights he does that, and some fights he decides to just kind of play on the back foot, pop a jab out there, and wrestle almost when he needs to. And he's a guy that used to train primarily, and I'm interested to see who he has in his corner for this fight because it used to normally be Adrenaline over in London, and Bazooka Joe Valtellini's trained there in the past. He's had Mark Hominick in his corner before. If I'm not mistaken, Hominick was actually in his corner in his last fight. Chris Horodesky used to be in his camp, so a lot of big names at Adrenaline. But when I look at it for Malcolm Gordon, it's an interesting road to the UFC because he was the TKO flyweight champ in Quebec. If you want to see a wild Malcolm Gordon fight that's not in the UFC, his fight before that against Yoni Sherbatov, who used to be on The Ultimate Fighter, has his own gym in the Montreal area. That was a wild, wild fight. Like, Malcolm almost gets finished, then he rallies back. There's like a slam in that one, and he ends up getting the submission win. But in the UFC, losses to Amir Albazi, a loss to Sumedergi, and then the win over Francisco Figueiredo. It's been a mixed bag for Malcolm Gordon.
It really has been. And you bring up his wrestling. It's such a weird part of his game because it always feels like he goes to it only when he has to, and it always comes a little bit too late because this is the problem with Malcolm Gordon. And it's not really something he can fix in his game. He's just not the most durable guy in the world. Like, we've seen it happen a lot throughout his career. When he gets hit clean, he normally gets hurt as a result of it. And even look at the Figueiredo fight. Like, against Figueiredo, who fights a lot like his brother, but kind of like a store brand version, like take some of the air out and then a lot more of that air out and you get Francisco Figueiredo. And if this was like the women's flyweight division, then beating the champion's sibling is probably enough for you to get a title shot. But unfortunately for Malcolm Gordon, there's a lot of steps in between Francisco and Devison. This is my issue with Malcolm Gordon, though, especially in this matchup against Denis Bondar, who we'll get to here in a second. With Malcolm Gordon's game, other than his lunging forward kind of style with his blitzes, I worry about how he's going to find sustained success throughout this fight. Because with Bondar, he himself is a very aggressive striker. And he is unique because he isn't the best guy at fighting backwards. So you might think, okay, Gordon is going to have some success. But I think the power that Bondar is going to be able to meet Gordon with every single time they do kind of clash on the feet is going to be a lot for Gordon to deal with. And when you do bring up his wrestling and it's sort of coming in a step too late, let's say he does find himself on the back foot, or if he's the one reacting to the strikes or even the wrestling of Bondar, I think Gordon's going to have a really hard time defensively in this matchup, because if he's thinking wrestling when they're striking or if they're striking when Bondar decides to go wrestling, I just think Gordon's going to really struggle with Bondar's ability to switch it up.
This needs to be said right now. If you like Denis Bondar, if you're on Topology, if you're on SureDog, if you're on the UFC's website, I don't actually know what his record is. We have it as 16-3. That's what they have on Topology. But SureDog has it as 14-2. And on the UFC site, they have it as 12-1. And then if you go to the UFC's website, this is the biggest head scratcher out of Denis Bondar before we really break down his technique and what he brings into the cage. He started fighting professionally in 2015. He had an amateur career from 2017 to 2019, he was the Gamma champion over in Southeast Asia. It was like a sponsored event by ONE Championship. This is my question. How can you be a pro and also an amateur? It doesn't make any sense. So that is one head-scratching thing now. Those fights on Tapology, they don't count those fights as pro fights. But still, he has amateur fights after he started competing as a pro. But what I really did like about him, I mean, other than the fact that he shares a last name with the first Canadian female in space and the first neurologist that ever made it to space, you know, Roberta Bondar. When I look at it for Denis, he takes liberties in his striking because his ground game is so damn good. And he's one of those guys that once he gets you down to the mat, he might make some positional mistakes, but he is very much finish over position. He's submission over position. He's ground and pound over submission. When he decides that he wants to put away his opponent, it's knee on belly, it's whatever he can get to keep a guy down to just go for that finish. So it's one of those things that could really, really cost him against some high-level opponents. But when I look at Denis Bondar, and you want to go back and you want to see some of the fun fights that he's had, the one that he had before coming into the UFC, the fight against Kanan Jafardi, that's a decent one. But the one that I really like to go back and watch is the one against Q and Jacques, where he gets himself into all sorts of compromising positions. Yes, he ends up with the win there. Yes, he ends up with yet another finish. But Denis Bondar, interesting fighter. But again, well, a little bit better in the striking, but I wonder how it comes out in the wash with the wrestling and the grappling.
Well, I'm glad you brought up that Jacques fight, because here's the thing about Bondar. I genuinely think he should win this fight in most areas, if we're being honest. But his record's a little bit padded, and the one time he did fight a guy who did have a good record on his own record, he was tested quite a bit before he was able to get that finish. That is a good point that you bring up, because with Bondar, the positives are very eye-catching, but there are some negatives. Like you brought up, some of his positional awareness on the mat is a little bit concerning. Like, he lets his arms get wrapped up a lot when he tries to posture up to get down any of his ground and pound, and he is good at posturing up with his ground and pound, but he does really like planting his opposite arm on the ground, and you see it in some of his fights, it gets wrapped up, never to the point where a guy kind of like shifts their hips and goes for the armbar, but you can tell that, okay, like let's say Brandon Moreno is the one on his back in that situation. I know we're talking about a guy making his UFC debut, but still, he'd be able to figure that out just like that and snatch up an arm. It might not cost him against Malcolm Gordon, but those are some holes in guys' games that they get away with, and then the second they get into the rankings, they still have those bad habits in their games, and then it gets picked up on by superior fighters.
So it'll be interesting to see what we get out of this fight, because again, for Gordon, he picks up his first win against Francisco Figueiredo. That fight was about 6 months ago, and for Denis Bondar, his last time out was a year and 5 months ago, so a little bit of time on the shelf. Fights falling out last year. The odds on this fight, the average on best fight odds, Bondar minus 250 favorite, Malcolm Gordon coming in somewhere around a plus 190. If we look over on Tapology, votes are a surprise to us. They are to you, Matt. I'll say over under 70% on the UFC newcomer. What would you say?
I think they'll be over.
You think they'll be over? Look at that. 862 total votes, 84% Bondar. You get 56% by submission for the 16% that of Malcolm Gordon, 71% by decision. And I think if Gordon's going to get a win in this one, again, you look at Bondar, whether it's one loss, two losses, or three losses, you go through and look, he has been submitted in the past. He also is going to be making the cut down to 125, which he definitely has throughout his career. Just should be noted, the last time that he fought was for the WWFC Bantamweight title. So I'm sure it won't be a big issue, but definitely keep it in the back of your mind. When I look at this fight, though, I think Denis Bondar should be able to get the win. Again, a little bit better in the striking, a little bit more creative. And yes, Malcolm Gordon working that at Toronto Top Team, working that with the guys over at Adrenaline. But I think once this hits the mat, as good as Malcolm Gordon is on the ground, I think Denis Bondar is just going to be a step ahead.
Yeah, I like Gordon offensively on the ground, but defensively he does leave a little bit to be desired. And if Bondar is able to posture up and start getting some of that ground and pound off, I don't know how Gordon's going to be able to respond to that. Because, again, Gordon can have some of those flashes on the feet with some of his strikes, but I don't know how he's going to be able to sustain output for 2, 3, 4 minutes. Just do enough to win rounds in this fight, so I do like Bondar.
Big time fight coming up this weekend. Both of us going with Ukraine's own Denis Bondar to get the win in his UFC debut. Let us know down below who you have. Do you have the Canadian Malcolm Gordon? Do you have Denis Bondar to get the win? We got some big time fights coming up this weekend, including another Canadian, Marc-André Barrio, taking on Chitty Bang Bang and Joe Kawani. And in the main event, Sean Strickland and Jack Hermanson going at it. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, we have Brazil's Danilo Marques, one of the biggest light heavyweights you're going to find in this division, welcoming another one of Brazil's biggest light heavyweights that you're going to find in Jailton Almeida. Now, if you go and look for tape on Almeida, you're going to find him by Jailton Almeida. You're going to find him by Maladinho. You're also going to find him by Jailton Jr. So you're going to find three different guys. It's very difficult. And there's a lot of Facebook tape that you're going to have to watch if you're looking for it, but it is out there. And for Almeida, he's one of those guys that had very good experience coming into Dana White's Contender Series. He fought a couple of UFC veterans, one of which, an Alcantara. So that was a lot of fun, and submitted him, by the way. But he is one of the more interesting prospects that I've seen coming into the UFC in the last little bit. And we've had a lot of prospects coming in over the age of 30 or thereabouts. I mean, even on this card, Chidi Njokuani did not need Dana White's Contender Series, but it's probably a way to kind of get that wage in a little bit cheaper for the UFC, which is a little bit of a joke, but more of a dig at the promotion. You've got Bondar coming in at 29, you've got Almeida at 30, and you've got Trayshawn Gore making his debut. He is 27, so a very polished fighter. Now, coming back a couple of weeks ago, you had Simon Oliveira, who was 30. You had a couple of different guys making that debut over 30, losing their debuts as well. But they didn't have the skills of Jailton Almeida, because this guy calls himself the Brazilian Khabib. And when I watch him fight, I think, yeah, but you're a better striker. So that's what makes this very interesting. I mean, for Almeida, he goes out there and has lasers when he's striking forwards. He kind of does a little bit of an edge spear into his takedowns, but whether it's a body lock or by this odd double leg that he does, he gets guys down fast. And once he gets them down, he's wrapping their legs. I'll throw the picture up there right now. Wraps their legs, go to push for position, gets that rear naked, gets whatever he wants. And it is a lot of getting guys down, keeping them down, and finishing the fights very quickly. And that's why when I look at this fight, Almeida, one of the more athletically gifted fighters that we have on this entire card, taking on Danilo Marques, who, yes, this fight, was it supposed to first happen in February? No, this is a fight that was booked late in, what, November or thereabouts? The fight fell out. You go over to Danilo Marques's Instagram. He had a great big, like, wrap on his elbow. That seemed to be the reason. So, out due to injury. But he's been in the gym, he's been training, he's a guy that spent time at Damian Maia's gym down in Brazil before moving to the States, working at a King's MMA, and you see over on the Instagram, him on his pedal bike with Shogun Hua, the boys just having a good time at the beach. But when you look at Danilo Marques, he was one of those guys coming into the UFC that I had absolutely zero faith in, and all of a sudden he's 2-1 in the UFC, and he almost beat Kennedy Nshukwu in his last fight until his cardio fell off a cliff, so maybe he should have spent more time on the pedal bike. But he has for this fight, Matt. When I'm looking at this one, Almeida is a super, super uber prospect who trains with Carlos Felipe. Yikes, you saw it a sussy right now. But coming out of Salvador, where I have a hard time getting a read on some of these guys. I mean, I really do, because he's fought at welterweight in the past.
Wasn't there a guy like 2 weeks ago who you were like, he's a wrestler from Ecuador, it's a big deal? Like, if you don't know about a guy from Brazil, then he's probably going to be good. That's all I'm saying.
No, that much is true, but I don't like to make the generalizations. But when I look
you
at...
You said Ecuadorians were good at wrestling.
When I look at Almeida, he spent time fighting at welterweight. He's also fought at heavyweight. And when he's fought at heavyweight, he kind of said, like, in some of the interviews, even before Dana White's Contender Series, he did one with Guillermo Cruz of MMA Fighting, where he said, yeah, you know, I'd probably like to just come into the UFC and fight at heavyweight. Light heavyweight be cool, but I could fight at heavyweight and be up there with my teammate Carlos Felipe. So, again, one of the bigger guys in this division. He has some of the most callous knees I've ever seen coming into the UFC. You know he works the mat. But in a fight like this, Matt, both of these guys very adept with their jiu-jitsu. I think we're going to get a fun fight.
I do too, but I'm going to warn everybody about Almeida, because let's just be honest, you brought up a lot of the positives, but I do feel like it's important to shine a light on a few of the negatives in his game, because I don't love his striking style at all, because he's such a good grappler, and I like what you brought up about his ability to shoot in four takedowns. He is very quick at being from the longest range possible to right in on your hips in half a second. He's very good at that. But he lunges into his strikes in a very similar manner, and that does have me worried, because he leaves his chin very high up in the air when he does throw those strikes in combination, and he does something that normally I look at as a massive positive, but with him I worry a little bit. While he's striking, he will switch stances, but it's not really like he's doing it on purpose. It's just his way of walking forward, because his feet will just move and his arms will follow, and that's good. He is huge. He is this super athlete, and when he does hit you with strikes, people go down because he is so athletic, but the technique behind it isn't all that great. And at 205, let's say he did fight a guy like Yuri Prohashka, and I know I keep on going to the top of the division, but even Nikita Krylov, for instance, who can land some straight shots down the middle and grapple a little bit, he might give him trouble. I think this is a great sort of launching point for Almeida, though, because if he is the guy who we sort of set up earlier on, and I think there's a world out there where he could get into the top 15, I really do, because if you take the best version of his submission game, which is very, very physically strong, but also there is some finesse to it. Like, Charles Oliveira is always who I use as an example for a guy who doesn't look like he uses any physical strength to get his submissions. Like, he's never muscling guys' arms at a position and then cranking things. It's all very by the book. With Almeida, he's so physically strong, but he does have the technique behind it that I do like him against most guys on the mat. But like you said, that's where this fight becomes very interesting. And I do think we are primarily going to get a grappling match between these guys. And for me, it'll be interesting to see how Almeida fares in a extended grappling match against Marquez. Because like you said, Marquez looked great in his last matchup until he didn't. And once the cardio fell off, he wasn't a great fighter once he was tired. Like, Draymond Green had this quote last week where Steve Kerr told him that he's like, you're one of the worst meaningless basketball game players I've ever seen. Like, if things don't matter, you're just really, really bad. With Marquez, some guys, when they're tired, they can still look okay and they can still pull off some techniques. With Marquez, he does just go into survival mode the second his cardio fails him.
And for Marquez, I opened up the video saying I did not have a read on this guy coming into the UFC because he took on some of the worst competition I've ever seen. He came into the UFC not off a contender series. He came off a win in 2018, debuted in September of 2020. So from February 2018, September 2020. That's a really long layoff. He beat a guy that was 5-4-1. Before that, he beat a guy that was 0-16. Like, you can understand why I didn't think Danilo Marquez was going to be very good in the UFC. Beat Titus Ibrahimov, who was not very good in the UFC. And then he went out there and he submitted Slow Mike Rodriguez, who is not good on the ground. He can strike, but he is not
good. He did look good in that fight, to be fair.
Yeah, so...
You're right, though.
When I look at this, I mean, again, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt from Danilo Marquez. You also have that from Almeida. Almeida with a little bit of boxing experience. They said on the broadcast on Dana White's Contender Series that Almeida was supposed to be in the UFC beforehand, but there were visa issues. You go and look, I never saw any fights booked and never heard a conversation about that. Researched it extensively, could not find a definitive answer, so I don't know how much stock I put into that. But at least the UFC had eyes on Almeida, if it tells me anything. So I do look at this one. Again, he had that win over, it was Ildemar Alcantara. Ednaldo Oliveira was another one that he had, a guy who had a couple fights in the UFC, albeit he lost both of those fights. I just want to say this about Almeida. Again, he wins his last fight on Contender Series, submits the smaller fighter in Nasruddin Nasruddinov. But if you look at it, he's been in a lot of grappling tournaments lately. The wins that he has, though, again, Edvaldo de Oliveira, when he fought him, he just runs across the cage, takes him down, and then spends time just grappling on his back. His opponent was 44, almost 45 years old. Before that, he's fighting Ildemar Alcantara, again, UFC veteran in that fight, was 2 months away from his 38th birthday.
Now, to be fair, though, Nassereddin Nassourdinov was actually pretty good. Like, he
and he was a favorite in that.
Exactly. Fight. So it wasn't just like this is one of those contender series guys who was a minus 600, beat his opponent like he was supposed to, and then, oh, wow, now Dana White can sign him. Like, he did face adversity, and he did fight a really good grappler in his last matchup, and that's what gives me a little bit of confidence in this fight against Marquez, because he was able to out-grapple a very talented, what was it, judo? Yeah, Nassourdinov was really good at judo. A really good judo practitioner, and he was able to out-grapple him once it hit the mat too, which is really impressive to me, because it's one thing to go out there and out-strike somebody who's a natural grappler or out-grapple somebody who's a striker. When you can beat somebody by what they're supposed to be a specialist in, it really proves how good you are in that talent.
Sambo, if I'm not mistaken, Sambo, for Nassourdinov, but very close. The other thing that I want to say before we get to the odds, if you look at it for Marquez, in those three fights, and he's lost the one to Kenny and Shukwu, where again, cardio failed him, 4 of 16 on his takedown attempts against Ibrahimov, 4 of 7 against Slow Mike, and 2 of 12 against Nshukwu. But the really telling thing is the control time in those fights, because 7 minutes and 16 seconds against Ibrahimov, 7 minutes 39 seconds against Slow Mike before he submitted him, 7 minutes and 42 seconds against Nshukwu. He's kind of a wet blanket once he does get to the ground, and he can take his time going from position to position, trying to get his submission. And once his opponent pops back up, he just stays on them like a wet blanket, drags him back down to the mat. So this will be an interesting fight, because for Danilo Marquez, he's one of those guys, you're 36, just turned 36, it looks every bit of it. And he's a guy who is cardio not improving. However, looks like he has actually been working on it on Instagram and physically looks really, really good coming into this fight.
I doubt a 36-year-old's going to show up with better cardio, though.
You never know. This could be the
it's
one.
It's rare.
This could be the time. And for Almeida, again, he has all of those physical gifts and attributes that you like to see out of a guy making the debut, polished as it gets. But again, his striking, and I have this written down with two lines under it and a highlighter, car crash striking. So it scares me against a lot of guys. With Danilo Marquez, he just holds his right hand cocked and pumps his jab out there, and that's pretty much the extent of his striking. So when it comes to the odds for this fight, I do look at it for Marquez. He opened a plus 180 underdog. He's plus 298 right now on best fight odds. Almeida opened a minus 210, minus 395. And if we have a look at the Tapology votes, 864 total votes, 90% Almeida, 28% by submission, 55% by knockout for the 10% that are Marquez, 47% by decision, 31% by submission. I'm going to say this right now. If you like Jailton Almeida, cool. I have him to win in this fight, but at a minus almost 400, not a friggin' chance in hell, because I think Danilo Marquez has a great opportunity to get a submission as an underdog.
Submission might be a stretch, but I do agree that he could get the win as the underdog, because he is the steadier fighter. He's the more proven guy. Let's just be honest. Like, having three fights in the UFC proves more to me to a certain extent than just being a really bright prospect who is getting the first opportunity in the big show. But I do like Almeida. Let's say he is the best version of what we've sort of sold in this video. He could be a very fun and promising prospect. But, like, let's say he fights Alex Pereira next, or somebody of that level of striking. That's when I would worry, because the striking defense is something I am going to be concerned about until I kind of see him get hit in a fight against a high-level striker and get over that adversity, but I do like him in this matchup.
10 of Almeida's 14 wins are by first-round finish, so again, it is one that gives me pause, and this is one of the big underdogs on this card that I don't really see it. So for me, I've got Almeida in this fight, but I would not anchor a parlay with this pick whatsoever. I'd sit back with a pot and popcorn, and I would enjoy it. So both of us going with Brazil's Jailton Almeida Maladino Jr. We're both going with him to get the win. We have a big-time card coming up this weekend. I mean, Hakeem Dawodu taking on Mike Trezano. You got Nick Maximov taking on Puna Soriano. You're not going to want to miss any of it. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
One of these days, somebody's going to write a book, and at the start, in the prologue, they're going to say, Alexis Davis, boy, she always won her second rounds. Coming up this weekend, we have Port Colborne's own Alexis Davis, now representing California. She's going to be taking on Lithuania's Yulia Stolyarenko, a fighter who I've been very high on for a very, very long time, and it has not worked out for me, nor has it worked out for Yulia Stolyarenko. But do I ever have a story to tell you about this fight? Because straight up, it was a pleasure researching and getting ready for this one. You might laugh at me and say, Craig, you have too too much invested in Alexis Davis and Yulia Stolyarenko. And I would say, yeah, maybe I do, but this is what I do. So let me tell you, Alexis Davis never loses second rounds. And if you look at her 5-on-in, she's 1-4, and you might go, geez, well, that's not good. Yeah, it isn't good. Fine. But look at the level of competition. Caitlin Chookagian, Jennifer Maia, Viviane Araújo beat Sabina Mazo, who hopped up to 135, and then gets the win over, loses by decision against Pani Kanzat. But in those three fights against some all-time flyweight challengers, because they didn't win the belt,
a little.
They're just all-time challengers, she was able to win those second rounds, and she is the definition of Steady Eddie. She is the best utility player on your favorite baseball team. It's like a late-career Brett Gardner for the Yankees. You can still put him into pinch hit, and he'll give you a single. You can still put him into pinch run, and he might bite down on his mouthpiece and steal second base. Alexis Davis is that fighter. And why is she that fighter? Because she's a savvy veteran. And there's some qualities that you just can't pick up that when you watch an Alexis Davis fight, you go, oh, okay, I really get it. She can fight behind the jab. She can throw a good 1-2. She can mix in her wrestling if she has to. And she's always there in these fights. She's not getting submitted. She's not getting knocked out. Unless it's Ronda Rousey, you know, Royal Rumble winner in 2022. She's not losing fights that way. She can get outpointed. She might even get out-wrestled against a really, really good wrestler. But she's always in these fights. And now for Alexis Davis to go from losing to Pani Kanzat in her last fight to taking on Yulia Stolyarenko, who, I mean, really, Matt, I think it's fair to say both these women are fighting for their jobs at this point. Because
without a doubt,
Stolyarenko lost to Leah Letson after the Ultimate Fighter that counts as a UFC fight. And then she goes outside of the promotion. She wins the Invicta Championship against Lisa Verzoza in a split decision that could have gone either way, but was an absolute banger and left Verzoza with life-altering scars on her face. So that's kind of crazy. But that was a wild fight. And then if you look at it, she comes into the UFC, loses to Yana Kunitskaya in one of the most boring fights I've ever seen, and then loses to Julia Avila by submission. If you look at it this way, Matt, I mean, again, Ronda Rousey was the queen of the arm bars.
She was.
Yulia Stolyarenko is a close second because that's the way that she wins her fights. Great grappler. Recently earned a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt in November of last year. Trained a week in Belfast, Northern Ireland for this fight with Leah McCourt, Bellator's own, a very, very good fighter who happens to have a win over Manon Fiorot on a record. But when I look at this one, Matt, I don't think a week of training with Leah McCourt is going to make an ounce of difference in this one. Yulia Stolyarenko either throws one shot, or when she blitzes, she brings her hands down and she eats every shot.
Okay, I understand you're down on Stolyarenko, and understandably so. But let's not sell Alexis Davis like she's great at 37 years old. Yes, I like the second round thing too. But this is the thing about Alexis Davis that's important. And this speaks more to the second round thing than anything. Alexis Davis just fights at the same pace. And if her opponent falls off after the first, she will win. If they don't, she won't. And it's really as simple as that. Because with Alexis Davis, it's not like she has added new components to her game. She very much is the same fighter who fought Ronda Rousey all those years ago. And it is wild. Like, women's MMA has evolved quite a bit, even from the time that Ronda Rousey was champ. And, like, last night I had to Google it, because I was on Twitter. You know, I don't care about wrestling, but there's a lot of people who post wrestling stuff when you follow a lot of, like, MMA accounts on Twitter. I'm sure everyone else has had that problem, too. But I heard, I don't give a damn about my reputation. And I was like, oh my goodness, Ronda Rousey's back. So I was looking up, like, 2015 was a while ago. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like it was 2 years ago and Ronda Rousey was just champ. It has been a while. And Alexis Davis is the same fighter. She does throw, I would say, okay combos on the feet. A very upright and very squared up striker, I would say. She's not somebody like Wonderboy who has one leg very far ahead of the other. She does have a bit of a boxing style. But this is my problem with Alexis Davis. You're right. She doesn't get knocked out. She doesn't get submitted. She does get pieced up a lot, though, moving forwards into jabs, and that does concern me because she's somebody who shows damage very poorly on her face. She's in that Lauren Murphy, Nick Diaz category to where you've just taken a lot of shots, the scar tissue has accumulated, and unfortunately for Alexis Davis, like, even the Mazzal fight, she did win, but Mazzal hit her about three times, and her face immediately started to puff up, and that's always something I worry about with Davis at this stage of her career, sorry, because I do agree with you. Stolyarenko's not a great striker by any means, but let's say she is able to land that one big shot on Davis early on. Remember when, and you argued about this decision for a long time, when Gegard Mousasi fought Shlemenko in Bellator and broke his orbital early on in the fight, you could see one of those cases happen here where Stolyarenko hits Davis with a good shot, puffs up her eye, and then that kind of affects the rest of the fight. But I do like the steady style of Alexis Davis, because even on her worst day, I know what I'm going to get. Whereas with Stolyarenko, her best day compared to her worst day, I have no idea where the in-between even is.
That's the trouble. So for Stolyarenko, going back through it, I mean, she was on the Ultimate Fighter, season 28, went over Marcia Allen, a loss to Penny Kanza, a loss to Leah Letson in the finale. Again, she had that crazy weight cut scare February? Last winter, roughly. She was supposed to fight Julia Avila, and then she got up too quick, and, you know, you say it was a one-off, whatever. She fights Avila back in June. They had a really fun fight if you go back and watch that one. But again, she ends up getting submitted in that one. And the notes that I have on her, really good leg kick. She really does have a solid leg kick, but she kind of, like, drops her hands, throws the leg kick, and then gets right back and resets, and it takes her a long time to do it. Again, from long range, she just throws single shots. So it's one leg kick reset. It's a jab reset. It's a right hand reset. But then when she gets brought into the brawl and if she's fighting in boxing quarters, she does actually have a lot of success in some of these fights. Again, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt from Hodger Gracie in Amsterdam.
Wow.
Pretty neat there. But she's been a hometown fighter for a really long time out of her gym, a fighter house. And that's really neat to see. So when I look at the odds for this one, Alexis Davis, who's 1-4 in her last five fights, open a minus 200. She's a minus 219 right now. For Yulia Stolyarenko, open to plus 170, plus 176. Matt, if we look at the Tapology vote, surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 65% for Canada's Alexis Davis.
I think they'll be closer to 50-50.
Nope. Look at that. 828 total votes, 79% Davis, 88% by decision. For the 21% that have Stolyarenko, 65% by decision. Now, you go back and watch the previous videos. I picked Stolyarenko. I'm all over Stolyarenko. And now I'm not as high as I used to be on her. Listen, she has great jiu-jitsu. She has odd takedowns. She has lethwei experience. You know, the art of the, what is it, nine limbs? You can headbutt in that.
Yeah, you can.
Fun stuff. But for Yulia, it just really hasn't came full circle in the UFC. And when I look at a fight like this against Alexis Davis, I mentioned Verzoza and the scars because she cut her open really well. That's not normally how Yulia Stolyarenko fights. She doesn't normally brawl. She did in that fight. She did a little bit against Julia Avila. But again, she just doesn't really accept striking all that well. And when she gets hit, she got busted open against Avila. She got busted open against Verzoza. And she has a hard time coming back in some of those fights. So I think Alexis Davis is going to have the striking advantage. But again, Alexis Davis at a 2-1 favorite, 1-4 in her last five, and she's what? Just turned 37 4 months ago?
Even if I had a time machine and went back in time, I wouldn't bet money on this fight. That's how little confidence I have in either one of these athletes. Because I agree, I am going to pick Alexis Davis, but I'm relying on a lady who's been in the UFC for almost 10 years, and she's 37. Age catches up to everybody, and at 1-4 in her last five, it's not like Alexis Davis has been improving a lot lately, so we are seeing her on the back nine of her career, and let's be honest, even that's probably a little generous. She's probably like, I don't know, not putting on hole 18, but she's walking. She's got her cart walking from 17 to 18, I'd say. We're getting near the end for Alexis Davis, but I do think she'll be able to put it all together one last time and be able to beat Yulia Stolyarenko. Now, here's the thing. If Stolyarenko ever gets a UFC win, it's going to be this weekend because Father Time has caught up to Alexis Davis and she has fallen off a cliff, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Whole second round, Alexis Davis. She did a great job against Penny Kianzad as well in the second round, her last time out, but both of us going with Port Colborne zone, you know, in that Niagara region, in that Buffalo region. If we're going to make it international, we're going with Alexis Davis to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this fight and the rest of them. It's a big time slate of fights that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Clash of Styles coming up this weekend at welterweight. We have the Vanilla Gorilla Chase Sherman. No, I'm just kidding. It's Jason Witt taking on the Fresh Prince of Southern Florida, Philip Rowe. And listen, if you go to Philip Rowe's Instagram to see who he's training with to get ready for this fight, it is a very interesting cast of characters. Rodolfo Vieira's there because he also trains at Fusion XL. But, oh, they brought in Vicente Luque for this camp. They also brought in Bo Nickel, you know, the wrestler. So, a very good, strength of training partner there for Philip Rowe. Because, if anything, the one area where he struggles at the most in MMA is his takedown defense. And, yeah, it might be 50% in his two UFC fights, but it's bad. It's really bad. And once he gets taken down, he makes mistakes. Now, he does have the benefit of being one of the longer fighters in this division. And with that length comes the ability to wall walk, figure it out up against the cage. As long as the takedowns aren't in open space, he can pop himself back up. But with Rowe, he's one of those guys that really does struggle at trying to push the head down, at trying to get that body lock off of him. And once he's on the mat, he is kind of susceptible to just stalling out when he gets his back to the mat. He's one of those guys that's going to lock his legs up, that's going to hold on. Or maybe he tries to do something off his back, but he does really struggle there. Now, the other thing about him is, this guy's a finisher to the nth degree, and he has lightning in his hands. Now, his last time against Orion Cosi, he rocked him six ways to Sunday, and I was surprised that it didn't get finished at a couple of different points. He had a bad first round, had a great second round against an Orion Cosi that was unproven in the UFC. And the other thing to note, Philip Rowe missed weight in that fight, weighed 173.5, and he talked about it after the fact. You know, it was a tough one. I thought I was going to lose 4 pounds in the sauna right
beforehand. How was Orion's back in that fight, Craig?
It was not good. And in his UFC debut, this for Philip Rowe, he lost to Gabe Green, and he just kind of struggled to get started in that fight. So for me, Philip Rowe, very good striking, can definitely crack, and that's what causes Jason Witt problems. Because where Jason Witt is a very, very good wrestler, and he has a really high motor, picked up a what? Majority decision win his last time out against Brian Barberina. It was a fight of the night. 8 takedowns in that fight against the primary striker. But for Jason Witt, we've seen it in the UFC. There are some losses to Takashi Sato. He also has a loss to Matt Semelsberger. He gets knocked out.
Jason Witt's kind of like Amir Khan. There's a lot of positives, but a glass chin kind of erases all of those. And that is the issue with Jason Witt. Durability has always been his Achilles heel because he has a great wrestling game. He is a great grappler when he is in the top position because he gets into that really heavy side control, or sorry, half guard, and he rains down nice ground and pound. He has a good submission game. And honestly, the thing about Witt that I think is a little bit underrated is his own stand-up game, because he doesn't have great durability. Now, let's say he was able to go in there and kind of eat a shot and give a shot. I think Jason Witt would be a great fighter and a very
Hall of Fame level fighter.
He would be a definite handful to deal with. But the issue is that he knows he isn't all that durable. So on the in-between and the middle range, there's almost sort of a hesitation to what he does. Because if he does have any question marks in his own game, it's okay, when do I shoot for the takedowns? When do I be a striker? Because when he is caught thinking about what he's going to do, that's when he gets cracked by a big shot. It's happened before throughout his UFC career. It's happened throughout his regional fight career. And against someone like Philip Rowe, who has a 10-inch reach advantage. And I don't think people understand just how significant that is.
Like, I have that underlined.
Well, yeah, and like, 10 inches is wild. Like, we talk about a 3-inch, 4-inch reach advantage as this massive benefit for a fighter to have. 10 inches is ridiculous. And the thing about Philip Rowe is that I don't think he can defend a pure takedown from Jason Witt in this fight. He's going to have to use his range and his footwork like his takedown defense, because Witt is the much stronger guy. So I think if he does get in on Philip Rowe's hips, he's going to be able to secure the takedown. I'll be honest, like 8 times out of 10, I do see him having quite a high success rate with his takedown attempts if he is able to close distance. It's just every time he goes into that mid-range where Philip Rowe has the chance to crack him with a counter shot, what we call the Kenny Loggins range, the danger zone, I don't think he's going to be able to hit the power of Philip Rowe. Because, again, the big problem with Jason Witt that we always go back to is the positives are great, but if he gets hit by one clean shot, he at least gets wobbled.
So, Chance Wren counter, who else? Justin Patterson, Hugh Pulley, Takashi Sato, Matt Semelsberger, all the men to knock out Jason Witt.
Like the Semelsberger fight. Like, I don't think Semelsberger, skill-wise, is that much better than Jason Witt in anything. It's just the durability is the difference between those two guys more than anything.
I think it's length and striking.
I don't look at Jason Witt and think that he's some vastly worse fighter than Semelsberger is. It's just the fact that Witt has that one massive hole in his game.
The one nice thing for Philip Rowe is he's one of those guys, and you go back even to the Shabazzian fight on Dana White's Contender Series, he's not good at first rounds. He's not good in that fight. He gets cracked. He has to rally to come back. You look at it in his UFC debut. He takes on Gabe Green. He falls behind early. And then in his fight against Orion Cosi, He had a bad first round, but then he rallies back and Kosi got tagged and tagged again. So all the credit in the world to Philip Rowe. I look at the odds for this fight, Matt. Witt open a plus 135. He's roughly still there. Rowe open a minus 155, somewhere around there, minus 160. We look at the topology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say, well, they popped up accidentally, so it's not a surprise anymore. But 880 total votes, 80% Rowe, 73% by knockout. For the 20% that have Witt, 74% by decision. Jason Witt gets caught clean on the feet, but he has a wrestling advantage. Philip Rowe has poor wrestling. He doesn't actually have great striking defense, but his striking offense is really good. And when he's moving forward, when he's kind of getting out of some of those clinch positions, he can definitely catch guys. I think training with Bo Nickel for a fight like this is great. And Vicente Luque as well. So, Matt, when we really break this one down, it is a clash of styles. But what's the final pick here?
If Jason Witt wins, it'll be like a 30-25 decision probably. And we're going to look really dumb. Or maybe not we're. I might look really dumb for picking Philip Rowe, but this is my problem with Witt. The fact that he does have a 10-inch reach disadvantage means that he's going to have to shoot his takedowns from very, very far away for them to be successful. And if Philip Rowe is able to crack him, even one time early, to the point where it might not knock Witt out, but even if it hurts him early, then Witt's just not going to be able to be dedicated to any of those takedown attempts, or at least I don't believe so. And I do think Philip Rowe will be able to win it on the feet.
Jason Witt is just one of those guys. It's really tricky to try and figure out. And when you look at a reach advantage like that, it's definitely huge. But for me, a guy like that with a wrestling advantage, the way that Witt has, I mean, yeah, he's longer in the tooth. He gets knocked out, so on and so forth. But Rowe, I really, really hate the takedown defense.
Like, he gets knocked out, though, is never something you want to hear somebody say about a fighter.
No, that much is true. So both guys with giant glaring holes in this one, but I like the wrestling advantage, and that's normally the way that I go anyway. So me, going with Glory MMA and Fitness own Jason Witt to get a decision win in this one. You're going with Philip Rowe to get the win. He could do it any way he pleases, but most likely by knockout in this one. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have in a very interesting welterweight matchup. We got a lot of big time fights coming up, including the UFC debut of the former Bellator main eventer Chidi Njokuani taking on Marc Andre Barrio. And in our main event, that's also at middleweight, Jack Hermanson looking to take on a surging Sean Strickland. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at middleweight. We have the UFC debut of the former Bellator big man. It's Chidi Bang Bang Njokuani taking on Powerbar Quebec's own Marc-André Barrio. And for Barrio, he's one of those guys that switched up his camp in a big way. And he used to train out of the Quebec area. He's moved it down to Sanford MMA. It's paid off to great effect. And if you look at it for Barrio, coming into the UFC, loses to Christophe Jocko by split decision. He loses to Jun Young Park. Has that fight against Oscar Piotto where he wins impressively, but it's overturned to a no contest. And then he gets a win over Abu Zaitsar and his last time out, Dalcho Lunjambula. And if you've ever seen Marc-André Barrio fight, whether it was over with TKO against Fredericton, New Brunswick's own Adam Hunter, he was the middleweight champ over there and the light heavyweight champ. And size is going to be a big factor in this fight. And I'm interested to see these two guys square off because for Njokuani, frame-wise, he is the bigger guy. But he spent time at welterweight early on in his career when he entered Bellator. Had some of those weird catchweight fights at like 175. And then eventually made the move up to middleweight. But for Chidi Njokuani, he's a guy like Albert Duraev where I go, did you really need Dana White's Contender Series? Because he is a finished product, and he has been for a really long time. He's one of those guys that can get it done in so many different ways, whether it's long range or in the clinch with his knees. They're absolutely deadly. And you look at the strength of schedule for Chidi Njokuani. I mean, some of the losses, Brandon Thatch really early on in his career, Jeremy Kimball that ended up in the UFC, but he was thick. Wins over with Bellator against Ricky Rainey, Andrea Fialho that just made his UFC debut, Melvin Gillard, who the state of Florida doesn't want fighting, lost to Andre Koroshkov, went over Hisaki Kato, a guy who I always loved to watch fight, but just never really had it going on with
Bellator. He knocked out Joe Schilling in kickboxing and in MMA, so that's pretty cool.
That is cool, and then losses to John Salter and Rafael Carvalho. John Salter, yeah, he fought in the UFC. He's been at the top of the middleweight division with Bellator for a very long time. Rafael Carvalho, former Bellator middleweight champ forever. So listen, there's no shame in those losses. The trouble that I had with Chidi Njokuani and the reason that it surprised me in 2021, that he wasn't with Bellator anymore is because he doesn't fight very often. And that's the big thing. From what? Like the start of his pro career until 2017, very, very active. One fight in 2019, one fight in 2020, the fight on Contender Series 2021 for Njokuani against Mario Souza that he ends up winning. And now here against Marc-Andre Barrio. Matt, I know we don't have enough good things to say about either one of these guys, so I'll let you pick where you want to start. But for Njokuani, it's got to be a weird one, and Vegas doesn't disclose purses, but I wonder what they're paying him, because this is a guy that main evented three Bellator shows, co-main event in two spots. Like, I'm surprised that this is the way that it's gone for him.
I think this fight's going to go one of two ways, and there's not a single other possibility, and I think you'll agree with me, but maybe you won't. It's either going to look exactly like when Dakota Bush fought Slava Claus, or when Tyron Spong fought Sergey Karatanov, and I don't think there's an in-between whatsoever. Either Chidi Njokuani goes in there this weekend and blasts Marc-Andre Barrio with, like, a check knee to the body when he's coming in, hits him with a combo on the exit, drops him and knocks him out, or Marc-Andre Barrio is going to crawl his way to another decision. Because here's the thing, I'm going to sound really harsh when I say this, because Marc-Andre Barrio is a very, very good mixed martial artist, but I'm going to bring up a classic Dana White quote when he talked about Ben Askren. Do you know what the cure for insomnia is? Watching a power bar fight. Marc-Andre Barrio knows what he is really good at, which is a huge benefit. Like, there's a lot of times we talk about fighters like Sarah McMahon, for instance, who she might not always know what her exact skills are and might not make the fight that will at least give her the best chance of winning. With Barrio, he doesn't have that issue whatsoever. He knows that he needs forward pressure, smart striking defense, and an intelligent wrestling and clinch game, I'll say. But I'll be honest, if this fight's going to win any bonus money whatsoever, it's because Chidi Njokuani probably won.
And if you go back and you watch Marc-Andre Barrio when he took on Abu Zaitsar, it was because Zaitsar blew his load really, really fast, and Barrio comes back. The fight against Piotta, he looked amazing in that fight. The fight against Dalcho Linjambula, he outpoints him in that one. Now, getting ready for this fight at Sanford MMA, it's funny because one of the names that you brought up is a training partner of Marc-Andre Barrio. It's a guy who has no takedown defense, but all boxing, kickboxing, Tyrone Spong. And he also trained a little bit with Dalcho Linjambula, who he just fought. So really interesting stuff from Barrio.
Small world.
But when I look at this fight, yeah, I mean, for Njokuani, he's one of those guys that he can mix in the takedown of his own. He can mix in the upper body throws. I would not do that against Marc-Andre Barrio. You're going to struggle there. But if he is in a clinch position, he can definitely have good success getting himself out of there with that upper body pressure that he does have and really starting to go to the body with the knees. Because unlike brother Anthony, who just lost over with Eagle FC, Chidi is much better at the wrestling than his brother, who was a great kickboxer. So when I look at the odds for this one, Njokuani opened a plus 120 underdog. He's minus 109 right now. And for Barrio, opened the favorite, minus 140. Again, pick 'em odds for this one. The Tapology vote surprised us, they are to you. Matt, I'm going to say 60% for the guy who's been with the promotion for a bit. And Barrio, what would you say?
I'm going to flip it. I think Chidi will be the favorite.
Chidi being the favorite? No, 877 total votes, 65% Barrio, 82% by decision, 35% on Njokuani, 50% by decision, 39% by knockout. I think this is going to be a great fight. And with Barrio, he's one of those guys. We talked about it with another Canadian, Alexis Davis, on this card. Steady Eddie. Marc-Andre Barrio has one gear and he does not get out of it. And I just wanted to throw it out there. In his last fight, he actually bucked that trend, so proving me wrong a little bit. The significant strikes that he had against Dalcho Linjambula, round 1, 15 strikes. Round 2, 38 strikes. Round 3, 65. He did the same thing against Abu Zaitsar. But in his other fights before those two, normally keeps a great pace throughout. Chidi Njokuani can do the same thing, but he can also finish fights late as well. So I think this fight matched up very well, lined very evenly. It is a tough one to try and make a pick on.
I just laugh because you said this is going to be a great fight. It'll be a great fight if you're in Power Bar's corner, I think, because I really do think he's going to be able to slow this fight to a halt. And this is one of those fights where if you're looking at who's going to have the higher ceiling or who the promotion probably wants to win, like, they probably want Chidi Njokuani to win. He's an exciting fighter, and like you said, he does have a bit of a backstory. Like, it's not like Justin Gaethje's coming over from World Series of Fighting, but it's not like you just have a random guy who won Contender Series now making their UFC debut. I do think the general audience, maybe not everybody, of course, but you know what I mean, there's at least some people who recognize him from Bellator. And I do think that if he does win this fight, it will be by finish. It'll be very spectacular. But I do see Barrio grinding this to a halt, putting him up against the cage, going for takedowns, maybe not securing all the takedowns, but making it one of those fights where he gets Chitty down to the ground and Jokawani kind of gets back up and gets his posture broke. I just think Barrio is going to be able to make it boring.
To me, I look at this one and Barrio was a guy, he struggled against Christoph Jocko in a close fight, but Jocko's one of those guys that can fight off the back foot, throw a lot of volume
at you. A male Caitlin Chookagian.
Lost to Jin Young Park, and I think Chitty and Jokawani really kind of embodies a fight style like that.
Where I hope.
He can get it done at range, he can get it done in the clinch. He's one of those guys that if he gets taken down, I do worry about him in a fight against a guy like Barrio, maybe more so than some other guys, but I do like Njokuani in this fight. I think he's a better striker, and I think he's going to be able to get the win coming up this weekend. So we're differing on the pick. Matt going with Quebec's own Marc-André Barrio. I've got Chitty Bang Bang and Joe Kawani, a name that Michael C. Williams always loved to put a little bit of spice on, over with Bellator. But it should be an interesting fight nonetheless. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight and the rest of them coming up on this card. We got a great one. So keep you locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Tricky fight coming up this weekend at featherweight. We have the former Ultimate Fighter season 27 winner. It's the lone wolf, Mike Trezano. He's taking on Calgary, Alberta, Canada's own mean Hakeem Dawodu. And I couldn't be more fired up for this fight because you have two guys that can strike like the top tier of this division. And they're looking to break the rankings and knock on that top tier. And for Hakeem Dawodu, well, he tried to do that in his last fight. He ended up losing to Movsar Evloev. He got 10-8 in the second round, but he rallied in the third round and looked really good. So for Dawodu, it's been a mixed bag in his UFC tenure. And the one thing that I want to do is open it up to a question here, Matt. I want to ask you, I mean, who do you think had the higher ceiling as a prospect between these two guys?
Personally, I always felt like Dawodu did because A, his style is a lot more eye-catching. So if he does end up getting on a decent win streak, I do feel like the UFC could boost him up the rankings a lot faster. With Trezano, it's odd because he felt like he was really hyped up coming off of the Ultimate Fighter, has his loss, and everybody forgets about him. So I feel like Trezano at least has more distance to cover to get back to where he was.
And the craziest part about it, Hakeem was undefeated. Obviously, he had the draw over with World Series, but he was coming in as a super young prospect, the next great Canadian thing. And then he gets submitted by Danny Henry really quick, and the hype train is totally over. Now, he's won 5 fights in a row, and if you look at it for the last 4 of them, a win over Kyle Bochniak, a win over Yoshinori Horii, who, man, you want to read a story about Horii. He beats Julio Arce by split decision. He beats Zubair Takhigov by split decision. He's a split decision machine. Oh, wait, so is Mike Trezano. And if you look at it for Trezano, he beats Joe Giannetti in the finale of The Ultimate Fighter by split. He beats Luis Pena by split. He loses to Grant Dawson by submission. He beats Ludwig Klein by decision. And the craziest part for Mike Trezano, from The Ultimate Fighter finale to his last fight, so 4 fights, he was a plus 135, plus 150, plus 135, plus 190. Underdog. He's been an underdog in every UFC fight. He's also an underdog coming up this weekend. We'll talk more about that coming up. But for Trezano in his last fight against Ludwig Klein, his pressure, his ability to get back up to his feet, and a strong third round won him his last fight. And when I look at the judges' scorecards, I go, what? Huh? All 3 judges saw that fight totally differently. Adelaide Bird had first round for Klein, second round Trezano, third round Trezano. You had Cleary, Trezano, Klein, Trezano. And then Junichiro Kamijo went, Trezano won all 3 rounds. So it was a really tricky one. MMA decisions, 3 had it 29-28 Trezano, 11 had it 29-28 Klein. All there is to say, Ludwig Klein looked bad in the third round. He was gassed. He looked terrible. And he was a decent favorite in that fight, should have won it. Mike Trezano, off for a very long time between the loss to Grant Dawson and the fight against Klein. A little bit of a surprise, but when you look at it for his game plan in general, it really is to pressure guys, to walk them down, and he can definitely learn some things from his teammate over at Tiger Schulman's, former opponent of Hakeem Dawodu, Julio Arce, to really try and pick it up, carry the flag, and get the win.
I agree with you, but I think Trezano needs a takedown to win this fight. Personally, I don't think he can stand and just purely strike with Dawodu in this matchup. Now, it's weird because I've been trying to think of, okay, what other sport can I compare this to? And I guess basketball is going to be the easiest one, and this is going to be tough. Hakeem Dawodu is kind of set in his combinations in, like, a mechanical way. Like, remember when Giannis in the playoffs took 10 seconds every time and had his whole routine before his free throw? Like, he had to do that routine for everything to be right mechanically for the ball to go in. With Hakeem Dawodu, he really only throws, like, three combos Holly Holmes style or, like, Carlos Condit style. He's just really good with those combos. Like, Dawodu likes that left hook, right leg kick, but he does it a lot. Like, a lot. And it's one of those things where if that technique works early, he's going to keep on going to that well over and over and over again, and it's going to be a very successful fight for him. But if it doesn't, then he does have a hard time sort of being more fluid with his stand-up game. He's not somebody who can just sort of go on the fly and think, okay, these are the new set of combinations I'm going to go to. With that being said, though, I think he's the much more powerful striker than Mike Trezano. And it is odd because, like you said, both guys are sort of those split decision kings. They do fight to very close fights. But this is how I look at Hakeem Dawodu. He's kind of similar to Paul Felder, to where he doesn't have the best volume ever, but his power's not where I'd like it to be either, since he doesn't have very high volume. He can't really go out there and at least dominate a fight just going, you know, 1-2s and leg kicks, but he can't just go out there and get somebody out with one big shot either. He's kind of in that in-between, and that always worries me, because let's say he does give up one takedown in a round and he's held down for a minute. It's really hard for Dawodu to do anything else significant in that round to get that big moment back if he isn't able to secure a knockdown. So for me, Hakeem Dawodu is really interesting because you kind of know how his fight's going to go from the first minute to the last minute. Either he's going to have early success, just sort of be sustainable throughout and do the same thing over and over again, or he will face adversity, fall back a little bit. Like you said, he can come back in the third round, but normally when he does face adversity, that's kind of an easy way out.
The odds on this fight, Dawodu will open at minus 200. He's about a minus 188, 185 thereabouts. Mike Trezano open a plus 170. He's a plus 155. If we look over in Tapology, the votes are a surprise to us. They are to you. I'm going to say over under 75% mean Hakeem.
I'll say over. I think he's a bit, yeah.
Yeah, he is. 899 total votes, 82% Hakeem Dawodu to get the win, 79% have him to win by decision for the 18% that have Trezano, 78% by decision. So apparently a finish would be a surprise. I look at this one, Mike Trezano is a good striker, and he really mixes everything in well. Like, his overall game is very good. You might not see it on the stat sheet that he has good takedowns, but he does actually have good takedown defense.
He showed it off in the Pena fight.
And he did show it off, again, in that Ludwig Klein fight. He was aware enough. Now, Klein was able to get four takedowns, and who thought he won that fight? Maybe I did. But when I look at this fight, Hakeem Dawodu throws a ton of kicks. About a fifth of his shots are kicks. And if he mixes it up that way against a guy like Trezano, who Tiger Schulman's are known for guys that can strike and push a pace on fighters, he's kind of squared up in his stance, kind of like Sean Strickland actually is in the main event. So very similar there. Kind of like a guy like Calvin Kattar as well, where he can just overwhelm you with his volume. But Dawodu, statistically better volume, albeit different sample sizes. But I do like Hakeem Dawodu in this fight. I think he does have the better striking. But I'm really eager to see this fight. I mean, we have this fight on our Fight of the Night screen for a reason.
And it's an oddly important fight. Because like you had said, both guys did have some hype when they were in that prospect role. And I do think they both moved past it. Like, you're both over 30 at this point. You've had a loss in the UFC. You have higher expectations for where you're at. You have higher expectations than for where you are currently sitting. So I do think a win is very important for both guys because it will get them back to where they previously were.
Third Canadian on the card, and we get him to get the win. It's me and Hakeem Dawodu with Alexis Davis and Marc-Andre Barrio also on this one. If you missed those videos, go back and check them out. And coming up, I mean, hey, Puna Soriano taking on Nick Maximov. I'm excited about
should
that fight.
One.
The main event, Jack Hermanson taking on Sean Strickland. Should be a great one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
I absolutely love this fight. Coming up this weekend at Bantamweight, we have Fortis MMA's own Miles Johns taking on the Sexy Mexi out of Minnesota. It's John Castaneda. And there's a lot of reasons why I like this fight. Because for John Castaneda, a little bit of a surprise signing coming into the UFC. You look at the 5-on-in. And it's 2-3. He had two losses. He won a fight. Comes into the UFC. Loses to British Eric Silva. You know, Nathaniel Wood. And then he comes out and he fights Eddie Wineland. And listen, we can joke about the fact that Eddie Wineland's an extra in Red Dead Redemption. But in that fight, Wineland pushes a pace. Uses his boxing. Castaneda catches him. And finishes him to Jason Herzog, who stands on top of Eddie Wineland. And is like, no, you're okay. It's okay. Hey. You're a legend.
You'd probably feel good if you woke up and Jason Herzog was reassuring you like that, though.
Good or strange. I'd rather it was Chris Tyone and I just felt odd. But when I look at this fight, we have Miles Johns, who, I mean, is a superb fighter and had a close fight against Adrian Yanez. Wins that fight. Bantamweight champ over with LFA. Comes into the UFC. Absolute buzzsaw. Fights Mariel Bautista. And eats a flying knee for dinner and gets finished in that one. So it was really a bit of an odd coming back process for Miles Johns, because this is a guy that there's a lot of hype behind, a lot of fan support. He loses that fight against a guy who doesn't fight often enough. Mariel Bautista and Benito Lopez, two guys that I just wish fought more. So what do they do with Miles Johns? They put him on a road to getting back into some wins. He fights Kevin Natividad, knocks him senseless. And then his last time out, he fights Anderson Dos Santos and does the same thing. And he looked amazing in those two fights. He was able to handle the pressure of Natividad, a guy who is in and out on a line. When you watch Natividad fight, in and out on a line, wrestling. And those are things that Miles Johns is very good at. And for Anderson Dos Santos, he's all power. He has no breaks and he has no off switch until you put him out. And that's what Miles Johns is able to do. But in a fight like this, I see it as very interesting because Miles Johns has really good boxing. He really does like to plant and throw, and he does it to great effect. He finishes a lot of fights. He also has very good wrestling. It was one of those things that I wanted to go back and look at. So for Miles Johns, we got to give credit where it is due. He was a Kansas State high school wrestling champ, wrestled the year in college. He was team captain. He was forced out due to injury. John Castaneda also has a good wrestling background from, and I want to make sure I get it right, Minnesota State Mikado, and that's good. He's also a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu brown belt. There's so many things that I can talk about in this fight, Matt, because I've really given a lot of praise to Miles Johns, but I think this fight, matchup-wise, I think it's a really good one.
I have to disagree slightly, because when a guy making his UFC debut is older than the guy who we look at as the very hyped up prospect, it is somewhat cause for concern, because with Castaneda, I do agree, there are a lot of positives in his game, but it's a big ass to, or not in his UFC debut, sorry, it is a big ass though for Castaneda to show up and beat Miles Johns after coming off the Wineland win, because here's the thing, and I'm glad you said it, because it does apply to both guys. When Johns lost to Bautista, they gave him two performances to kind of go back to the lab, work his way back into shape, and sort of get the opportunity that a lot of prospects aren't afforded, if we're being honest, and get him back on track, which is a great thing. It's very Bellator of them to do. Whereas with John Castaneda, he loses that fight, and then he comes back against Eddie Wineland. He loses to Nathaniel Wood, who's still a really good fighter. And that's the thing that I do think we need to bring up. You might disagree with that, and you say he's the British Eric Silva, but I think Nathaniel Wood is still a borderline top 15 talent in this division. So if you lose to Nathaniel Wood, in my mind, I don't really care that much about that, but I don't also care that much about you finishing Eddie Wineland early. Because with Wineland, it's interesting. If you go, let's say, 3 rounds with him and then you knock him out, we're going to learn quite a bit from that. But the way that Castaneda was able to finish him, he hurts him early. And the problem with Wineland is that at this stage of his career, this isn't when he fought Hedin Barao, folks. This isn't the same guy. He can't recover all that well after he does get initially stunned. And that was the real sad thing to watch in that Castaneda fight. It was awful to watch. We could talk about Joe Lozon Cowboy later, because I think that'll be a very similar fight to watch. But still, for Castaneda, I still have a lot of question marks, because I'm not all that bothered by his loss in the UFC, but his win doesn't erase a lot of those sins either. And with Miles Johns, it's interesting, because he lost that big fight to Mario Bautista. Anderson Dos Santos doesn't prove that much to me by beating him, but I do really like Miles Johns boxing on the inside. The issue I do have with it is his own over-aggressiveness, because against Bautista, gets him caught by a big knee, and when you look at this division, there's a lot of really tall, lanky, rangy strikers who can use those up-the-middle techniques, so I think Miles Johns is that hyped-up prospect. I just think that there are going to be fighters on his way through the top 15 that he's going to have to get strategically matched up with. And the last thing I will say, how fun would a rematch against Adrian Yanez be? Like, if the UFC could somehow put that fight together, let's say Johns is victorious this weekend, I think that would be a great fight that they could go to down the line sometime.
It's going to be an interesting fight coming up this weekend too, because Johns fights out of the orthodox style, and you have Castaneda, who maybe they list him as switch, but he is a southpaw, and he throws a lot of kicks. And Miles Johns throws kicks too. I mean, again, I talked about it. He plants and he throws when he boxes, but when he does move around, he does throw a fair amount of kicks. The thing is, the movement in this fight, this is how I can see it going. Miles Johns usually moving forward. John Castaneda moves side to side. He can get backed up a little bit. When he gets backed up, all he does is kind of pop a jab out there, but he is always kicking. Miles Johns, if you go through it in the UFC, hasn't faced a southpaw. He did face a southpaw on Contender Series. Now, you can draw a little bit from it, but you can't draw a lot. So here's what I will say. He wrestled Richie Santiago and wrestled and wrestled and wrestled. And when they stood up, all he did was box his head in. He did not throw a single kick against Richie Santiago. So I'm interested to see how he fares against a southpaw who kicks and kicks and kicks. Because of the calf kicks of John Castaneda, who has legs like tree trunks, if it is able to take effect, it zaps all that power out of the boxing. So, Miles Johns, I would say, is a better wrestler. Castaneda has a background in it as well. Miles Johns, better boxer. Castaneda, a little bit more creative with his strikes, and he has that kicking ability. So when I look at the odds in this one, Johns open to minus 225 favorite, minus 245 right now. For John Castaneda, open to plus 190, plus 200 or thereabouts. And if we have a look on Tapology, votes are a surprise to us there, to you, Matt. I'm going to say the over, under, I'm going to say 85% Miles Johns.
I would say around there, yeah.
All right, 868 total votes, 93% Johns, 68% by decision, 24% having to win by knockout. For the 7% that I have Castaneda, 48% by decision, 35% by knockout. So Matt, I'm going to take the smallest little sliver of that pie, and I'm going to take John Castaneda. I think he's going to win by decision. I think those leg kicks are going to be absolutely key. And I think being a southpaw in a matchup like this is going to pay out to, you know, it's going to surprise a lot of people. I really do think. I think Miles Johns is a super prospect, but I really do like the experience that Castaneda has. I mean, if you look at it on Tapology, it doesn't tell you the whole story. 12-1 amateur record. 18-5 pro record. Like, he has a ton of experience against some really good guys, and he's had split decisions against guys like Jose Aldai, who had a good fight on Contender Series as well. I like Castaneda in this fight. I think he's gonna get it done.
I disagree. I really do. Here's the thing with Castaneda. He does drop his hands when he throws a lot of his kicks, and I think that's a prime opportunity for Johns to level him with an overhand. And this is the thing. When you have opposite stances, I know a lot of the times people believe that it benefits the kicker, but if you do fight a boxer, we've seen it a lot more recently. Like, Calvin Kattar put a spotlight on this. When you crowd kickers, it forces them to become boxers. And when you focus a lot of your time on your kicks, and then that becomes an eliminated part of your game, you're not going to be as good at pure boxing as the pure boxer who's pressuring you. And I do think that Johns is going to give Castaneda a lot of trouble with his forward movement. I do think that if he is able to go to the body and to the head like we've seen him do, it should be a really fun fight. And this should be one of those, like, fight of the night style fights. But I do like Johns' ability to close the distance and make guys pay for it when he does close the distance.
Absolutely love this one. Matt going with a pretty big favorite in Miles Johns. Look at the big underdog in John Castaneda to get the win. I can't wait for this fight because it should be either one way or the other way. It should be a good one. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. We get some big time fights coming up on the rest of the card. Hermanson taking on Strickland in the main event. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Roses are red, violets are blue. Don't let a wild pube wreck you. Yes, I said that. Valentine's Day is just around the corner, and our sponsors at Manscaped are here for you with the best tools to get your balls ready for the special occasion. It's V-Day, and it's time to join the 4 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped, the leaders in below-the-waist grooming. With our exclusive offer, go to manscaped.com and use the code FNP for 20% off and free shipping. Matt, why are clean balls so important, especially on Valentine's Day?
Well, here, we're in very different situations. You have a wife, I am single, so I don't know what your plans are, but hey, I might go out, I might meet some people or see some people, and you want to make sure that everything is high and tight on the inside. Everything's well grooved, looking up to par. And here's the other thing too. I know you're going to get to it a little bit later, but I can't say this enough about the Manscaped products and how all of their smells are very similar and how nice of a thing this is. Because listen, yeah, remember when you were in middle school and you were like putting on Axe, and then maybe you'd like have deodorant too, and there was like 9 different smells you were coming at people with? No one wants that. We're all adults now. You're using Manscaped products. The fact that everything does sort of follow the same scent platform or profile, let's say you forget to use the cologne one day and you have the shampoo on, you don't really feel like you missed out because you're still going to smell somewhat similar.
So there's the refined cologne. You can pick that up over on the site. It gives you a good smell. Now, I would suggest you spritz that in the air, walk through it. Then you're gonna really get that on yourself. But if you don't get the opportunity, you can also pick up the body wash. Now, with the body wash, it says right on there, ultra premium cologne fragrance refined. You can also get the nice 2-in-1 conditioner shampoo mix, and it's something that I use every day when I do wash my hair. They're nice bottles. You hear that? That's metal. And if you do head on over to their website, I mean, listen, there's a lot of different things that you can pick up, including the Performance Package 4.0. You're going to get the special gift of the Shed Travel Bag, but also included, and the biggest portion of it, you're going to get the Lawnmower 4.0. Now, right now, I have the travel lock on. The three LEDs came on. So 1, 2, 3, they should go down. And then all of a sudden, I'm ready to go. And if it's Valentine's Day, I'm ready to go. There's a 4000K LED light right there. And another really good part about it that I like is the serviceability. I can pop the head off. I can get at that motor if I got to lube it up and get it ready. And I'm not just talking about Valentine's Day. I'm talking about the Lawnmower 4.0. I'm ready to go. The other important key for me is the weed whacker. And we all know my nose hair problem, but
above your coffee too. Bold move.
Yeah, that is a bold move, but it did actually happen on the show. So Manscaped, they've created their products for a night just like this. They'll make your V-Day date say, wow, great set of balls you have there. Listen, go to manscaped.com for the exclusive offer of 20% off and free shipping with code FNP. Your balls and significant other, whoever you have with you on that night, they will thank you. Get 20% off of free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off of free shipping at manscaped.com. Use code FNP. Join Cupid and shoot your arrow with Manscaped this Valentine's Day. We have a tricky, winding road of a card up this weekend. Main event, Jack Hermanson taking on Sean Strickland. I can't wait for it. So as we always say, keep locked with Fight Night Picks. And
let's get into it.
I'm going to ask a question to the audience out there. So if you're listening in the car, this is going to be a really tough one to respond to, but you can do your best. And if you're following along on YouTube, you let us know down below in the comments section. Are you confident in Julian Erosa as almost a minus 300 to get a win over Steven Peterson coming up this weekend? Because that is what we are faced with. Juicy J representing Extreme Couture taking on Fortis MMA's own Ocho Peterson. And for the Ocho, he had a really long layoff between fights. I mean, he lost, a couple in a row. Luis Pena loses one to Alex Caceres. Then he takes on Martin Bravo and knocks him out with a spinning back fist and wins a performance bonus. And then between that fight 2 years and 3 months ago to his last fight, which was about 7 months ago against Chase Hooper, a litany of injuries. There were bone chips and an elbow that had to be removed. There was a COVID issue. And then there was another issue that he didn't really talk about on any of his interviews. They just kept saying undisclosed injury and he wouldn't talk about it himself. So it was a minor tear in something. But he comes out his last time out, takes on Chase Hooper, and put himself into some spots that a lot of people wouldn't against Chase Hooper and had a lot of success in them. So for Steven Peterson, he's gotten the win in his last two fights. He's coming in as a sizable underdog against Julian Erosa, who has had three chances in the UFC, is 4-1 in his last five. And if you look at the loss, one against Sungwoo Choi, well, that's fine. And then he gets the win over Charles Jourdain's last time out in a fight that he wasn't winning until he did. Like, that was pretty fun. And Matt, before I hand it off to you, you can see it up there in the graphic on the first one. There's an asterisk next to both of the weigh-ins. Julian Erosa had a catchweight fight that was on short notice but planned at 150 pounds. So he weighed in at 149.5. Ocho missed weight his last time out, weighed 148.5. There's a set of rules that our universe has to follow for everything to work. And one of those rules is that if you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball. And if that's true, Julian Erosa should be able to beat Steven Peterson, because if you can beat Charles Jourdain, you can certainly beat Steven Peterson. Like, I understand we're both concerned about the odds and whatnot, but let's just call a spade a spade. Julian Erosa went out there, ate bombs from a very dangerous and young power puncher who has a wide variety of strikes, goes to the body, goes to the head, and who in his own right has a fairly good gas tank, which is wild because Julian Erosa beat him down with so much pressure that he made him have a bad gas tank. Okay, we were all there. I'm not gaslighting anyone right now. Steven Peterson beat a 19-year-old in his last fight. That's cool and all, but like, Chase Hooper to me is like, he's like a rookie that your favorite basketball team drafts in like the 20s. He's coming off the bench. You're excited about the promise, but every time he comes into the game, the other team goes on like a 10-0 run and they immediately got to get him out. It's like, okay, that was fun, but there's some holes in his game. Chase Hooper's the type of guy that the UFC should cut just to do him a favor, to give him a regional deal, to build himself back up, because Hooper is a classic Sage Northcutt example of, hey, you're young,
You're exciting. You're pretty good with a microphone in your hand. Let's push you a lot. I just can't put a lot of stock into Steven Peterson beating Chase Hooper. And don't even get me started, because you know what's wild? Beating Chase Hooper might be more impressive than beating Martin Bravo, because Bravo in the UFC was not very good at all. Now, if we're going to give Peterson his credit, because we have to say this, his knockout win over Bravo is one of my favorite knockouts ever. He counters a spinning back fist with a spinning back fist, a galaxy brain moment, and it lands in the most impressive fashion possible. Just, to me, I know you can't always go off guys and their last performance, but Julian Erosa looked as good as he's ever looked against one of his harder opponents he's had in the last few years, whereas Steven Peterson was in bad positions against a guy who isn't really UFC caliber, if we're all being honest. Just, for me, I agree with you 100%. It's odd matchmaking for where both guys are in their careers.
Julian Erosa does not have a good chin. You've seen that time and time and time and time again. Like, I can't stress that enough. And then all of a sudden, he fights Charles Jourdain, and I don't know what he ate that week, but it definitely paid out. So the weird thing for Erosa, we talked about this earlier on the card. If you missed the video, go back and check it. It was about Jonathan Almeida. Julian Erosa is one of those guys, and if I could stand up and give like a Luke Thomas-esque breakdown, or if I had the old Fox Studios, because they used to like to do this with the UFC. When he comes in to strike, he switches stances as he strikes, and he moves his head real weird. Like, he has a unique style of his own. It's very Julian Erosa-esque. And I think the guys at Extreme Couture, Coach Eric Nixick, they've really been able to fine-tune his defenses and accentuate some of those strikes that he's able to throw. Because Erosa is one of those guys that is kill or be killed. He has good submissions. He has good striking power. And in some fights, he just turns it on as the fight goes on. Sean Woodson is the fight that really kind of wins out. The Woodson fight, the Jourdain fight. You look at those, you go, geez, like this guy on his best day, maybe he could fight for a title.
No, let's not.
And then you look at Julian Erosa on his worst day, and I mean, he gets knocked out by Julio Arce. He gets knocked out by Devontae Smith. He gets knocked out by Bobby McIntyre. He loses to Paddy Pimblett. He gets knocked out by Taruto Ishihara. He's over on The Ultimate Fighter fighting guys like Artem Lobov and get knocked out. So Julian Erosa, if you don't believe me, and that's why I started the video off, if you like him as a 3-1 favorite,
you're probably related to him.
Cool. But that could bust a parlay. I ultimately, without even talking about them, but I will talk about them. Erosa open to -235. He's a -286 right now. Ocho open +200. He's +222. Over on Tapology, surprise us, it is you, Matt. I'm gonna say 87.5 over under. Erosa, what are you saying?
I'll say under.
All right, Matt. Look at that. 886 total votes, 92% Erosa, 49% by decision, 33% by submission, 11% by knockout, the 8% that I have Ocho, 45% by decision. If I know anything about Steven Peterson,
this is the fight he knocks out Julian Erosa.
This is the fight where his striking's not bad, his wrestling's not bad. He just gets beat by guys that are better than him. Like, look at it. Alex Caceres.
And that's most guys in the UFC level, if we're being honest.
That's true. I just had a rough one right there. It was like the time that Aaron Andrews, after a Boston Red Sox playoff game, she goes, Jared Saltalamacchia, what's it like to be able to beat Charleston Fist's record? And I thought, who's Charleston Fist? I thought it was Carlton Fisk. But regardless of all of that, Ocho, when he's gone up against the better guys in the division, he just hasn't come out on the winning end. And you look at the guys that he's beat in the UFC, and if we go for the last three, Matt Bissett by split decision and an Ultimate Fighter finale, Martin Bravo and Chase Hooper, it just really is hard. Could Ocho go out there and bust everybody's parlays this weekend? I could see it. I'm taking Julian Erosa for the sake of this show, but I am sitting back and eating pop and drinking popcorn.
I think Juicy J's got this one again. You can't beat Charles Jourdain and then lose to Steven Peterson. I refuse to live in a world where that is the truth. It should be a really fun fight, though, because Steven Peterson always does come to fight. And it's not like he's just going to let Julian Erosa pressure him a bunch and then he's going to wilt over and get submitted. It will be fun, but I do see the pressure of Erosa eventually winning out. And we all know what happens when his cardio advantage does kick into a fight. He's one of the better guys of going for the kill once his opponent does start to wilt under the pressure. So I do expect that from old Juicy J.
Big time fight coming up this weekend. Both of us going with Extreme Couture's Julian Erosa with so many asterisks and cautions out there. It'll make your head spin. So let us know what you have, who you have, who's going to get the win. Is it going to be Ocho Peterson? Is it going to be Juicy J? Big time fights coming up. And on this main card, I mean, look, all of a sudden, Punahele Soriano taking on Nick Maximov, you know, Nick Diaz Academy's own. And in the main event, Jack Hermanson and Sean Strickland, you're not going to want to miss. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
The real Ultimate Fighter Season 29 finale, we get it. Now, do you think Brian Battle has to go home, look at the display case, shine off the trophy, bring it in, and if he loses, does he have to give it to Trayshawn Gore?
I think this should be like an AJ Styles-Kurt Angle match where it is for the gold medal. So yeah, winner takes all of this.
It's for the gold medal, and on a week where two former UFC champions win the Royal Rumble. Did I watch it? No, but it was all over my Twitter timeline last night. We have Trayshawn Gore, Mr. Vicious, taking on Pooh Bear, Brian Battle. Now, Matt, I think Pooh Bear is the worst nickname in MMA. If it's not that, then it's Daywalker from Rashad Coulter, and I'll take that to my grave. But coming up this weekend, Trayshawn Gore is an interesting prospect because you can see it up on screen. Is he 4-0? Do we count the three-round fight that he had against Gilbert Urbina? For the sake of our graphic, we do, but you could also say that he's 3-0. Taking on a Brian Battle who the same thing applies. He had that win over Andre Petrovsky that was a three-round fight, and then he ends up in the finale. Now, in that finale, we talked about it because it happened, and Gilbert Urbina gets the opportunity because Trayshawn Gore had a knee injury. He falls out of the fight. So the guy that Trayshawn Gore knocked out gets to fight Brian Battle. And in that fight, the guy that got knocked out, Gilbert Urbina, fighting for his family and his two brothers that were, you know, Hector, UFC adjacent, he knocks down Brian Battle. He stuns him twice. He takes him down a couple times in the first round. Gilbert Urbina looked great. And then in the second round, Gilbert Urbina had a hard time like he did in the fight against Trayshawn Gore because his chin just isn't all the best. And in that fight, he really did struggle. Battle gets the back, Battle gets the submission, and he gets the win. And at the end of it, Battle gets back up, and you couldn't really see it from the camera angles, but he gets up and he is cut open a bit. So a big time win for Battle. Gore obviously spends some time on the shelf, but he gets the opportunity in the UFC. We don't often see fighters that are 3-0, 4-0 getting a shot here. I mean, are you surprised that they ended up making the fight? Because I have to say I'm not.
No. Well, no, because we both watched The Ultimate Fighter. Strange question, to be honest, Craig. Because here's the thing. We know what we know about Trayshawn Gore with his wrestling background. And when you see how good he is in The Ultimate Fighter and just how dynamic his whole game is, for a guy who is only, what, 3-0, 4-0, depending on whose ranking you're or whose resume you want to listen to, this should be a great fight, though. Because Brian Battle, to me, is kind of where you would think a guy is in his career when he is coming off The Ultimate Fighter. Not a finished product, but still a guy who's far enough in his career to where you know what his strengths and weaknesses are. And I honestly can say the same thing about both guys, and that's why this fight is so fun. Because for Brian Battle, and you pull this up right now, he has an extensive amateur career, but also a really good professional one too. And with Battle, I like the fact that he does fight like a guy who has a lot more experience than he does, although he does eat damage in some fights, and that's not often something you would attribute to a guy who has good fight IQ. He is a great example of someone who can use his opponent's weaknesses against them. I always call this the Ally Quinta effect, because Ally Quinta is not a good enough fighter to truly beat Kevin Lee or to have a close fight with Khabib Nurmagomedov. It's just his style, for some reason, against wrestlers is so tricky that sort of his niche of skills works very well against those types of fighters. With Brian Battle, if you are a really good wrestler, he will play that game with you, don't get me wrong, but normally he can rely on his own cardio and his own ability to get his back off the cage to kind of win out in some of those exchanges. Whereas with Trayshawn Gore, if he gets in on a lot of those spots, he's going to finish that takedown 9 times out of 10.
Which is crazy, because I mean, when I look at both of these guys, if you look at it for Brian Battle, extensive amateur record, as you had mentioned, he fought Impa Kasanganai as an amateur and it wrestled the heck out of him. He fought Cody Brundage, who's in the UFC, and beat him as well. So he was also one of those guys that didn't have an extensive background in like Muay Thai or wrestling or anything. He just became an amateur fighter and was pretty good at it. And now look at him. He's in the UFC and he won The Ultimate Fighter. Now, if you do look at it for Battle over on that season of The Ultimate Fighter, beats Kamaran Lachinov, a guy who had spent some time over with Bellator, beats Andre Petrovsky, withstands a little bit of that early adversity. But if we know anything about Andre Petrovsky, he struggles in the second round. Didn't against, 4-2 Hu Yao Zhang or 3-2 Hu Yao Zhang, but he does normally struggle in second rounds. Battle's able to win out, gets a submission in that one. And I look at it, Matt, in this one, Trayshawn Gore's way faster of a striker. Way, way faster of a striker.
And his footwork, too. I would just say he's faster in general.
His footwork is very good. The trouble is, I look at Battle when he strikes, and his striking defense, he does one thing. I wrote it down. He has this weird part about a striking defense where when you start to strike against Battle, he puts his left hand up by his ear and he just kind of holds it there. And he keeps his right hand here and he rolls out of it like a rampage. He does roll out of it. But at the same time, he rolls into a lot of punches when he does it.
He does, but I do look at it very similar to you. It's a skill that if he is able to develop to 100% capacity, he will have sort of striking defense like a Rampage or a Dustin Poirier, to where you can have the high guard but still have a wide enough range to where you don't really miss out on your own eyesight and your ability to slip shots. But like you said, he is young in his career, and those skills do take a long time to really refine. And against a guy like Trayshawn Gore, like, your one mistake could be your last, because he is so quick on the inside and on the outside. And I do think speed is such a big key to this fight, because battle striking isn't terrible. He is very upright with his stance. He does plod forward a little bit, but it's not like his striking is a net negative. I just look at him to where, let's say he does stick the jab out and he is slow at bringing it back and he leaves his head wide open. That's when Gore is going to be able to jump in almost like a Chad Mendes, fake low, go high, and one big shot could be the last one of the fight.
And it is an interesting one, because you can see it for battle, he does have the reach advantage. He is so much more volume oriented than Trayshawn Gore, it's not even funny. And that's the thing that I really got out of doing all the tape study on both these guys. If you watch Gore, his fight against Ryder Newman, I mean, he won it, but like, he won it. That was about it. Newman tried to go for a late takedown in the first round, wasn't able to get it. The second round, not a whole lot happened. Gore was able to outpoint him. That was about it. And the craziest part about it is, Trayshawn Gore trains out of American Top Team Atlanta with the Lima brothers and so on and so forth. I mean, who else has trained? Rafael Assunção has trained there in the past. There's a lot of fighters that have gone through those doors. But on that season, he was on Team Ortega, and Tiki Gosen the whole time is just yelling at Trayshawn Gore to do anything. And he doesn't really do anything. And then in the second fight that he has, taking on Gilbert Urbina, that was the finale before the finale. It was the last episode of the show for the season. And he goes out there and he does kind of wait for the blitzes. He's able to counter. But again, when he lands his left hand, check left hook, lands, drops Urbina, throws a power jab, drops Urbina. Gilbert Urbina's chin has been checked a lot. Not even on the Ultimate Fighter. Not even by Gore or Battle. It's just been checked. And they both had a good opportunity to get their wins. Trayshawn Gore, tons and tons of power. So when it comes to this fight, it really is interesting. You look at the odds. Gore open to minus 135 favorite. Minus 165 are thereabouts right now. For Brian Battle, open to plus 115 is plus 135. If we look over on Tapology, I want to say this, Matt. I know when we put the vote out there for the Battle fight, when he's supposed to take on Urbina, there was so much hype for Trayshawn Gore in those comment sections. So I'm going to say over-under 73.5% Trayshawn Gore.
I think it'll be closer to 50-50.
I think it's going to be close. Look at that. 882 total votes, 61% Gore, 69% by knockout. For the 39% that have Battle, 47% by decision, 34% by submission, 9% by knockout. The last thing I want to say before I hand it over to you. Both of these guys kick. They do not kick the same way. Trayshawn Gore whips that leg kick out there very fast, resets really quick before his opponent can really do anything. Battle plays a lot of the game of switching it up to all three levels.
Throws
a nice teep to the body. They are a little bit slower, and he does have to reset where he's got to do that beach glamour pose of a defense. But when it comes to this fight, both very skilled guys for being so early on in their pro careers.
Without a doubt. This is the way I look at this fight, and I guess I also have a question for you, so I'll give you one last chance. Do you think people are buying high on Trayshawn Gore just because he also beat Urbina? Like, they both had the same last win, it's just Gore did it slightly more impressively, but it was an injury ago, and that's what people forget. Not just time has passed since the last time we saw Trayshawn Gore, he also did sustain a knee injury, and I know it's not like the most serious thing in the world, because it's not like he had to wait a year, but still, it is something serious enough that he did miss time due to it. So, do you think people are looking at Trayshawn Gore and maybe buying him a little bit high as a prospect going into this matchup?
It really is hard to tell, and I mean, for Gore, and I know we're going to hear about it down below in the comment section, and please do let us know who you have in this fight. I just have a hard time in a fight like this, where I've seen fights, whether it be regional, whether it be on the Ultimate Fighter, where it's a lot of waiting, and in that time Battle's going to be able to score. And so is Battle going to be able to win the war of attrition, or is Trayshawn Gore going to be able to go in there and finish that fight? That really is the question here, I think.
I'm not trying to put a lot of stock into Gore's last knockout win, but I do think he's going to be able to finish Brian Battle. I know that's a bit of a hot take because the odds are so close, but, and I know Craig hates it when I say this, speed kills on the streets and in the cage. And it's true. Like, when Brian Battle does everything, he is slow to rechamber a lot of his strikes, and he is slow to reset with some of his kicks. I do see Gore closing the distance at some point and at least landing a big shot. Now, will it knock him out? Will it drop him? That's all I really care about. Because if he can even drop Brian Battle and slow down some of that output, I think it will really help Gore. I just look at Brian Battle as he's either going to win this fight by 30-27 with his volume, and it'll be one of those games where he's throwing so many strikes that Gore can never really find his opportunity to land, but I think Gore is going to be able to find the in-between and at least land a big enough shot to change the outcome of the fight.
For me, I like Brian Battle in this fight. I like the well-roundedness. That's the real key in this fight. For Gore, yes, can he outstrike Brian Battle with his power? There's a good possibility. I mean, when you have power and you have speed, that's legendary. If you're a heavyweight with those two things, you win a title. You win a title. Francis Ngannou has those things, and now he has, you know,
the wrestling of Khabib and the jiu-jitsu of Damian Maia.
He's a wild man, and I love it. But when I look at this fight, I do like Brian Battle for the well-roundedness, the ability to go to all three different levels, and the fact that he is constantly doing something. If Trayshawn Gore, there's Trayshawn Gore fights that I love. There's Trayshawn Gore fights where he just pressures forward and bobs and does nothing. And in that time, I think Brian Battle is going to be able to score. So for me, I like Battle in this fight. For you, you've got the uncrowned champion of this Ultimate Fighter season.
We got to figure out this weekend. Again, it would be great if they could give a little nod to him or something if he is able to win. They're like, oh, and kind of the winner of the Ultimate Fighter. It's too bad that he wasn't able to get the opportunity to fight for the title of the Ultimate Fighter winner, but it is nice that the UFC is giving him the opportunity to, at least for his own sake, kind of get the win back.
Well, maybe they'll send Mick Maynard into the cage to give Trayshawn Gore something. We'll have to see, but listen, we're split on this pick. I've got your champion, your Ultimate Fighter champion, Brian Battle. Matt's going with the uncrowned champ, Trayshawn Gore. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Is it speed and power, which usually wins out fights? Or is it the well-roundedness and the volume? We're going to have to see. I can't wait for this fight and the rest of them on this card. We have two more big-time fights at middleweight, co-main event, and main event that you're not going to want to miss. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
There's a saying that we have with Fight Night Picks, and actually it's one of my sayings, that this is a weird bucket of muscles. And if the weird bucket of muscles was a fight, that's a fight coming up this weekend at middleweight. We have Smiling Sam Alvey taking on Megatron Phil Haas. And for Calvin Johnson, I mean, he's probably watching this fight going, "What? That's your nickname? It's Megatron?" Phil Haas is one of those guys that we knew about for a long time as MMA fans. I mean, Rashad Evans was really talking a big game about Phil Haas. He was a guy that trained at Black Zillions, Hard Knocks 365, Sanford MMA as it is now, training with some of the best in the world and some of the guys that are on this card as well. I mean, Marc-Andre Barrio, another one of the guys that was on that Eagle FC card with a winning Rashad Evans and Tyrone Spong. There are a lot of names at that gym at Sanford MMA that can really get you ready for some of these fights. But the one problem with Phil Haas that he's had, and it's not just a recent kind of, activity, is his cardio. And I mean, against Nasruddin Imavov, it really started to kind of show in that third round. And the fight that he had against Kyle Daukaus, in his last fight against Chris Curtis, he went out there and fought great at the start. But oh, by the way, Chris Curtis has great counterboxing and some of the best cardio you're ever going to find at 170 and 185. And Curtis was able to hit as a giant underdog. And then he would do so, another time again. And Chris Curtis is this mystical figure at middleweight in the UFC, a natural welterweight. Now, Matt, when it comes to this fight, Smiling Sam Alvey, it blows my mind that he's in the UFC in 2022.
It's like seeing DeAndre Jordan still suit up for an NBA team. You look at his stats and just how garbage they are across the board, and you're like, wow, why is this man still getting an opportunity?
Now, I will say this. Sam Alvey, credit where it's due, because if you look at him in his last, seven fights, he loses to Antonio Rogério Nogueira.
By stoppage.
Jimmy Crute. Clidson Abreu, who did not have a good UFC run. Split decision loss to Ryan Spann, where Ryan Spann had Ryan Spann had a Phil Haas in that fight, where he blew his load early, but he still got the win. A split draw against Daun Jung, a loss by finish to Julian Marquez, and a split decision loss to Wellington Turman. So, Matt, listen, that's six losses and one draw. Sam Alvey's still in the damn UFC getting it done. So, listen, Good for him. I'm not even joking. Like, good for him to stick around because most people would
really, though, because I got to be honest. I look at it a different way. I look at it as, hey, you're kind of taking an opportunity from other people who deserve it more. That's all. I just don't think he still is a UFC talent. Because here's the thing. At 35 years of age, Sam Alvey isn't adding new things to his game. Like, he's still the exact same fighter he was at the start of his losing streak. It's just that he does the same thing, and it depends on what look his opponent gives him. That's the only difference in the Sam Alvey fight.
I haven't seen the top-to-bottom mouth guard that he used to have.
That's fine. But Sam Alvey only walks backwards and throws left hands, and that's pretty much it. It is wild to me when you look at his record, and he has like 20 wins by knockout. It is an insane stat, because in the UFC, and especially on this run, A, he doesn't really have a lot of power unless his opponent just walks forward with their hands down by their waist. There is a fight, I forget who his buddy who walked with his Prakniak?
Martian Prakniak zombied it across the cage.
That was an awful performance by him. And Alvey did look like he was a good power puncher in that matchup. But Alvey is a low volume, I would say fairly durable, decent cardio fighter. And that's all you need to know about him. Nothing changes fight in, fight out. It just depends on if he can land a big shot at his opponent, rock them, or if his opponent has really bad cardio. Now, luckily, Sam Alvey finds himself in one of those classic Sam Alvey fights where, of course, his opponent only has those avenues to win. But I'm done picking Sam Alvey on Fight Night Picks, Craig. Like, we keep track of our picks throughout the whole entire year, and you've won 3 times in a row. Okay. You've won this award 3 years in a row, and I'm not going to allow me picking Sam Alvey, who hasn't won a fight in years and years and years, just to have you get one ahead of me. So I'm picking Phil Haas because I don't think Sam Alvey can get wins at the UFC level anymore.
If you're putting money on this fight, you're a silly goose. Now, I'm going to give credit where it's due, and I'm going to reel it back in a little bit because it's a friend of the show. Clint McLean over on Twitter, diehard MMA pod, he said that Chris Curtis was going to beat Phil Haas on question mark kicks with Fight Night Picks, and we said no, there's no way. And then it happened. So Clint threw the tweet out there, I want to say a couple of days ago. He's got 2 units on Sam Alvey to get the win over Phil Haas, and I just do not see it. I mean, for me, Phil Haas has bad cardio. Sam Alvey has consistent cardio. And if you look at it for Sam Alvey, he had one of those knock him out, drag him out type of fights with Julian Marquez. And normally those fights go to the favor of Sam Alvey. And once it got to the ground, it did not. It did not.
I was thinking, I don't even know. It just, yeah, with Sam Alvey at this stage of his career, you know what you're going to get, but it's almost a problem because you know what you're going to get. You expect, again, that low volume, okay power type of style, and of course that'll be the one time where he does land a big shot on Phil Haas, put him down in the first round, and wow, Sam Alvey's back. But I think Phil Haas, with his wrestling, just his wrestling alone, can go out there and at least force Sam Alvey A, up against the cage, similar to how Clinton Abreu fought him. And if he is able to actually secure the takedown off of the clinch control, I do think Phil Haas is the vastly superior grappler.
Now, it should be said, I mean, Sam Alvey, for his career, and he's been in the UFC since 2014, and even before that, he was on The Ultimate Fighter. And if I'm not mistaken, that was a Julian Lane one.
I think so.
I'm pretty sure that was Let Me Bang, Bro. But when I look at it, 81% takedown defense in a very long career, and that there have been a ton of fights in that, so it is quite good for Sam Alvey. I'm interested to see how he makes out against Phil Haas in that regard. Haas, -350 favorite right now. Sam Alvey, +270. If we look at the votes on Tapology, I'm not going to leave it open to interpretation or guesses. 891 total votes, 90% Haas, 65% I'm to win by knockout. For the 10% that have Sam Alvey, 55% I'm to win by knockout. I think Phil Haas beats Sam Alvey this weekend, but man, if you're confident with -350, you're a silly goose. Because Phil Haas, again, we brought it up with Sam Alvey, he's able to exploit certain things with game plans, and it's usually cardio and cardio and cardio, and he's able to counter with that left hand. So for Haas, he does come in there hot and heavy and does like to push a pace on guys, but he does start to tail off in certain fights. Sam Alvey's one of those guys, there's a reason why they match this fight up, that's able to take advantage of certain things that Phil Haas does poorly. And that's why I have a lot of hesitations in this one. If I'm going any further than just me saying, hey, the pick for Fight Night Picks is Phil Haas.
Here's the thing. I think Sam Alvey, at one point, was a borderline top 15 talent because he was able to go in there, fight some of those veterans or up-and-coming talents, and you didn't know what the outcome was going to be because he was a very good litmus test. But at this stage of his career, it has become, okay, if you lose to Sam Alvey, you get cut from the UFC, and if you beat Sam Alvey, we're going to give you another chance, and that's pretty much it. So I think Phil Haas is good enough to at least get one more chance in the big show, but if he doesn't start to fix some of those holes that we've seen in his game at some point soon, then I don't think Phil Haas is going to be that hyped up guy coming off Contender Series he originally was his second time around on Contender Series.
Both of us going with Phil Haas, and if we've seen it recently, the blonde hair move has worked for certain fighters. It's turned them into absolute juggernauts like Charles Oliveira, or if you're Gabriel Checo, you're just going to fish for leg lock attempts against Rashad Evans and lose
it the happens.
Teammate of Phil Haas. So both of us in this fight going with Phil Haas, but stay away from this fight and just enjoy it for what it is worth. We have some big time fights coming up on the rest of this main card, including two more middleweight contests between Puna Soriano and Nick Maximov, and in the main event, Sean Strickland taking on Jack Hermanson. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Absolute banger. Coming up this weekend at welterweight, this might be my favorite fight on the card. We have Kazakhstan's own Shavkat Rakhmonov taking on Guyana's own Carlson Harris. And I absolutely love this fight because both of these guys do the same things very, very well. They're both very unorthodox when it comes to the striking. You have the combat sambo master of sport background of Shavkat Rakhmonov combined with the awkward jiu-jitsu skills of Carlson Harris. And if you look at it, I mean, on paper, these guys match up so well against each other that they decided to sign on the dotted line and fight each other. And when I look at it, if you know Fight Night Picks, you know I'm a fan of the show. I think you should leave. And I think everybody should check it out because it's either going to be a giant hit and a home run. You're going to watch every episode multiple times over, or you're going to absolutely hate it.
It gets worse every time you watch it. I'm going to say that.
No, it doesn't. But if I could say anything about the way that Shavkat Rakhmonov fight, it's almost like he moves to the beat of jazz. He kind of brings like a cosmic gumbo to the octagon. Because for Rakhmonov, he's one of those guys that, whether it's Michelle Prezeris, who, I mean, he tested for everything after that.
The needle melted when USADA put it in his arm.
He already had, what was it, a two-year USADA layoff, you know, before that fight. But Michelle Prezeris, after his fight against Shavkat Rakhmonov, in samples from August, September, October, and November, tested positive for a couple of different banned substances. So a late career Michelle Prezeris, who already had to move from 55 to 70, got handed a four-year ban.
Like, do you think when some fighters pick up the phone, they see USADA, they're like, oh, Jeff probably just wants to have a word. I'm sure it's not that big. You know Michelle, when he saw USADA, he was like, oh no, they're on to me.
It was bad. But regardless, in that fight, it was kind of a talking point. The fact that Shavkat Rakhmonov had so much height and reach. And it was really interesting to see, okay, how is he going to figure it out? You can even hear the commentary team talking about it in the fight. Because if you look at it for Prezeris, what's one thing he can do in that exchange? He can throw a lot of leg kicks. Because if you're the much taller fighter and you can't figure out the distance, kicks are going to be thrown naked and you're going to have a hard time trying to back them up. And what does Shavkat do? He finally figures it out with the hands. He gets the takedowns. Now, I know he's not credited with takedowns on UFC stats, but it's those awkward exchanges, those body throws that he's able to get.
Remember when you got mad at me for saying UFC stats isn't always accurate? It's weird how that happens.
He's able to land them. He's able to get the finish. And it's an odd one at that. He's got his back to the cage with Prezeris in front of him and he's able to submit him. And the weirdest part about it is, you look at it for Rakhmonov, he has that master of sport and combat sambo in his back pocket. He really does use his body weight to his advantage. And if you go back to his UFC debut, he has really good balance when he's defending his takedowns. I thought that was one of the nicest things because against Alex Oliveira, who's just trying to get the underhooks and throw him, he just plants one foot and he just stays like nice on the balance beam and he's able to get out of them. If you look at it for Rakhmonov, he's a great, great boxer. He has great jiu-jitsu, great guillotines. Obviously, you saw that against Oliveira. But he can get in some firefights, and he was able to get in some really, really fun ones over with M1 Global. And the last thing I have, Matt, he's a former M1 Global welterweight champ. And if you look at it for Carlson Harris, former Brave welterweight champ as well. These guys are really high level.
I'm going to say this about Shavkat Rakhmonov right now. I think he's Vicente Luque without the resume right now. I really do. I think he is a ranked fighter without the ranking yet next to his name. Because when you look at his unique combination of skills, you bring up like combat sambo. And normally in the MMA world, like when you hear a combo sambo background, your ears perk up.
Combo sambat?
Sorry.
A big John
combat
McCarthy.
Sambo, sorry. Your ears perk up. Like normally people with those types of backgrounds go on to have extremely successful careers in MMA. Look at Khabib, Fedor, like some of the all-time greats have sambo backgrounds.
Blagoy Ivanov?
Blagoy. He survived more than an MMA fight
and
too.
Beat Fedor in combat sambo. combo.
Also got stabbed in the heart and lived through that, so he's faced adversity. This is the thing about Shavkat, though. He's a great long-range striker, he's a very good middle-range striker, and when fighters make it close, he's a big enough submission threat to where they can't just shoot volume takedowns, and he has really good elbows in close, too, so he can make guys pay for closing that distance. That's a recipe for a ranked fighter right there, because no matter what challenge you bring into the cage, he at least has a basic answer for it. It's not always going to be okay. What happens if Kamaru Usman shoots power double legs on him? Nobody has the answer to that. But when you ask yourself, okay, can he fight on the inside against someone who's clinch heavy? Of course he can. He has elbows, he has knees at the middle, and he's very physically strong for this weight division. At long range, I would honestly say he has a style somewhat similar to Jeff Neal. He will wait behind the jab, he's very upright and will throw some kicks. The thing I worry about with Shavkat, though, when he does start to fight more consistently ranked fighters, because listen, I think at some point he's going to be in the top 15, especially if he can get by Harris, is how is he going to face when he does fight those big power punchers who can get on the inside of his range? Because I would say if he has any weakness himself, it would probably be his own offensive wrestling game, because I think he will have a hard time sort of getting the bigger, stronger welterweights off of him because of his range. People are going to look at him and say, okay, I can't fight him at long range, we're going to have to fight him in close. And other than his submission abilities, which are very high level, don't get me wrong, I just worry about him a little bit with some sustained defensive grappling positions. But I look at Shavkat Rakhmonov and look at him as good of a prospect as there is in the UFC. I put him in the Ilia Topuria category. I put him in that Song Yadong category. I really do think that if he is able to start fighting on a more consistent basis, he really will be able to get into the top 15 sooner rather than later.
And we haven't talked about Carlson Harris enough, because this is a guy, you look at his last loss, it's to Jarrah Al-Salawi, a very, very good fighter over with Brave. And I mean, since then, big time wins. Now, he was featured on a show, it's called Dana White's Looking. Now, can you explain what the acronym means? What does FWD mean?
I don't know. Looking forward to a fight, I'm assuming. Oh, yes! That's what it was. They were getting ready for, like, Conor Dustin 3 or Conor Dustin 2. And they were going to do, like, ooh, we're looking forward to that big one. So, yeah, they did. It was a terrible marketing ploy. I'm not defending them, Craig. I'm just saying.
I was just trying to be funny. It was just a joke. It was a bad one. I was going to say full whittle devil, but...
What?
FWD.
Craig making jokes that no one understands.
But Carlson Harris on Dana White's Full Whittle Devil, looking forward to a fight. It was an interesting one because he was matched up against one of Khabib Nurmagomedov's teammates. And it was one of those ones where Khabib was there. Wasn't Salt Bae there too? And he was supposed to get the win. And then all of a sudden, he gets the win over Saigid Izagagmayev. And he gets a finish win in that one. And that was one of those ones where you go and you look at Carlson Harris. This guy is the master of, I wouldn't say defensive submissions, but a lot of darces, a lot of guillotines, a lot of gator rolls, a lot of special things. And the biggest part about Carlson Harris's game is he's one of those guys, goes out there and throws with reckless abandon because he can. And in some fights, you knock out Impa Kasanganayan. Yeah, it was a TKO and Impa kind of protested it. But I look at Harris as he has three different ways he can throw his right hand. He can throw a right cross. He can throw a right overhand. Or he throws it kind of like a club. And when he throws it that way, he knocks guys down. Like, and it's very unorthodox. If you were in a boxing gym, they probably wouldn't tell you to do this. But I'm serious. He throws his right hand out there, and it's almost like he strikes right there. It's a recipe to break your hand. But for Carlson Harris, it has worked for him. He knocks down Kasanganai. He ends up finishing it. But the biggest part to his game, and that's why I think this matchup is so interesting, because he will throw with a lot of power. He will throw with some volume too, which can cause Rakhmonov to get caught in a mirror, and he might get a little bit confused with it. But with Carlson Harris, the biggest part to his game, he gets you up against the fence. He goes for the body lock. He either gets the takedown or he ends up getting your back and he gets the submission. He is a very, very special fighter. And I think that's why this makes for such a good matchup.
I know I've hyped up Rakhmonov a lot, but I feel like it is justified because, A, he has no hype behind him other than, like you had said before the video, like Luke Thomas really likes him.
And us.
But that's the thing. Like, he doesn't get nearly enough credit as he deserves. He has 14 wins in MMA, 7 of them by knockout, 7 of them by submission. You want an exciting fighter? Well, he finishes fights. He can get it done on the feet. He can get it done on the mat.
In title fights, he doesn't just win to win. He doesn't Tyron Woodley his title
fights. Yeah, he tries to put you away. I just think Shavkat Rakhmonov is as exciting of a UFC prospect as there is. And maybe you don't even have him as a prospect anymore. He's 14-0. He's 27. He's still very young in his career. I just think it's time for him to start fighting those borderline top 15 guys. Maybe the legends, if you will, who have kind of fallen out of the rankings, or another really hyped up prospect. Because I see this fight as a lot of other Rakhmonov fights. I think Harris is going to leave himself open on the feet because he does overextend himself a little bit going for power shots. And if Rakhmonov can counter him even one time in the feet, he's got a big speed advantage, and he is a very intelligent finisher, too.
He's kind of like the Said Nurmagomedov of this division. He can really get
but
it done
big.
In a lot of different ways. He's big, and he can also submit you. Like, you saw Cody Stamann going for that submission. No, I didn't think Said was going to submit him like that, but absolutely wild stuff. And he's training at Sanford MMA, is Rakhmonov for this one, with guys like the Jaguar Paw, Loic Radjabov, Tyrone Spong, who I just keep mentioning, Nick Lentz, Fazeev's over there as well. We look at the odds for this one, and Rakhmonov opened a minus 175 favorite. He's minus 240 right now. Harris opened at plus 150. He's plus 192. And if we look at the total votes on Tapology, 905 total votes, 88% Rakhmonov, split 25% by decision, 31% by submission, 36-ish% by knockout. For the 12% that have Harris, 30% by decision, 41% by knockout. When I look at this fight, it's tricky because Harris was able to rock Kasanganai all the way into Eagle FC, where maybe one day he could fight Loic Radjabov. Maybe. Perhaps. Kind of crazy that Loic would even take a fight over there. But Harris got rocked by Christian Aguilera in their fight, which was weird. It was a shovel hook that rocked him. And then all of a sudden, Harris is able to start to strike with Aguilera, and Aguilera just goes for a takedown and screws himself.
Again, my prediction has nothing to do with Carlson Harris not being good. He's an insanely talented mixed martial artist. I just look at Shavkat Rakhmonov. Look at how clean he is on the feet. Look at his ability to finish fights on the mat. He does kind of represent the next level of MMA fighter. Like, he is a well-rounded mixed martial artist at his core, but he can finish fights on the feet and on the mat, which is something that's very uncommon.
To me, I just need to see Shavkat Rakhmonov. The only kind of, you know, big knock is just, I want to see him strike against the top level strikers. That's the thing. So if he's able to go out there and put on a good clinic here against Harris, that's what I'm eager to see. The one position where Carlson Harris excels is those upper body throws. I don't see that happening against Shavkat Rakhmonov at all.
He's
so
fast.
That's a big point that I have for this video. So for me, I have Shavkat Rakhmonov. I think he's going to be able to get the win. We're both in agreement in this one. But if you have Guyana's own Carlson Harris, you let us know down below in the comment section, because I think he's one heck of a fighter. And I think he really brings the yin to the yang of this fight. And these guys are going to come together and make something special. So I absolutely love this fight. We both have the fighter out of Kazakhstan here. And we've got a couple of big fights up at the top. Punahele Soriano taking on Nick Maximov. And in the main event, Jack Hermance and Sean Strickland that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at middleweight. They are giving Nick Maximov no favors and taking on Punahele Soriano coming up this weekend. With Soriano, he has the great wrestling background, and he's taking on some elite-level grappling that Maximov has. And if you don't believe me, look at his fight on Dana White's Contender Series. Now, yes, he fought a guy that wasn't very good. But in that fight, the craziest part about it is that although Oscar Cota was 11-2, and it was salt, Oscar Cota weighed 263 pounds there. Nick Maximov took the fight on short notice and weighed 209 pounds and out-wrestled him. Now, 29-28, whatever, he still was able to get the win and ends up in the UFC. Not necessarily on merit alone due to the fact that he represents Nick Diaz Academy. He makes his debut against Cody Brundage in a fight that was close enough. I mean, he was able to win out easily in the second round. First round was a little bit close. Brundage took the third round. But in that fight, Nick Maximov spent just about the entire time looking for a takedown. And if he didn't get it, then he'd start again and go for another takedown. So Maximov was able to go out there and out-wrestle Brundage, a guy who is very adept in the wrestling side of things. So I look at this fight, Matt. I mean, Nick Maximov, obviously training at Nick Diaz Academy. You're going to get better at your boxing. It looks like his main focus over on the Instagrams. You haven't seen as many pictures as he had last year with the old Submission Underground, because this is a guy who, at brown belt, is one of the better grapplers you're going to find at middleweight. The other thing with Maximov, they mentioned it ahead of his fight against Brundage, was the fact that during the pandemic, he spent a lot of time at Wildcard Boxing. You know, Freddie Roach's gym, kind of honing his craft. But the one thing I will say about that and about the Instagram and all that stuff, when you watch Nick Maximov strike, not necessarily just in his last fight, it is a lot of single shots that are across the cage. He spends a lot of time extending his distance to try and get closer to get the takedown. That's his ultimate goal.
It really is. And he's not a fighter who uses his takedown to then set up his... He's not a fighter who uses his takedowns to then set up his strikes. I know we talk a lot about Chad Mendes when we talk about a guy who fakes down and then uses overhand shots. Maximov really is the opposite end of that spectrum. And again, to bring up another fighter who probably just talked about too much, He should incorporate more of a Marvin Vettori type of a game plan to where I intelligently box my way into the clinching range and then go for the takedown, because you are 100% right. With Maximov, he is always shooting for takedowns. He does know his own game quite well, and if he is able to secure the takedown, you are messed up. Like, it's game over before he almost gets the takedown. That's how good his jiu-jitsu is. He can get it done with arm bars, leg locks, rear naked choke. Like, that's the level of BJJ that Nick Maximov has and brings into the cage. But the issue with a lot of guys who have that world-class jiu-jitsu and they kind of lack the wrestling is that we don't get to see a lot of that jiu-jitsu because they don't have the world-class wrestling to go along with it. And with Maximov, his wrestling's not bad, but it is very physically strength-oriented, and that does always make me worried when he fights a guy like Punahele Soriano, who, listen, is Puna the best wrestler in the UFC? Not at all. But is he intelligent about how he uses wrestling, offensively and defensively? Extremely. Like, I don't expect Puna to go for a single offensive takedown in this matchup. If he did, he'd be very, very silly because you'd be doing Maximov's job for him. But on the feet, if Punahele Soriano can defend enough takedowns to tire out Maximov, I have no doubt in my mind Soriano's probably going to finish him, because we've seen Maximov struggle with strikers in the feet when he does get tired. We're going to bring this up more in the main event, but there's almost some uncertainty in the striking up Maximo, because like you said, he is training his boxing, but he's not a boxer per se. He's not a trained boxer. He's someone who's training his boxing. He has to kind of think about what he's doing on the feet before he does it, and that worries me in a fight against someone like Soriano, who, let's say you are caught in the in-between of, oh, should I go for the takedown? Should I throw that single shot? That's when Soriano's going to catch you with a big overhand.
If you're somebody that just likes to look at the numbers, you might go on UFC stats and see Punahele Soriano has 100% takedown defense and go, wow, geez, it's good night.
He's like Camaro.
It's over. Brendan Allen's the only guy that tried to take him down. He went 0-1 in takedown attempts. So you got to pump the brakes a little bit with that. Now, with Punahele Soriano, went to D3 Wartburg College in Iowa, and he was an All-American over there. So he did have really good luck with the wrestling. You know that to be his background. He's a wrestler before he's a striker. It just so happens that he is a very, very powerful southpaw. So I'm eager to see this matchup because both of these guys are southpaw, so it could end up like the Spider-Man meme, but when it does come down to it, Soriano is the much more polished striker coming out of Extreme Couture, and when I look at this, it's just such an odd fight. If this is truly our co-main event this weekend, I scratch my head because Soriano's coming off a fight where he got out-volumed against Brendan Allen, who, when he decides to be Muay Thai Brendan Allen, he's a very special fighter, unless he fights Sean Strickland, who happens to be in your main event. Nick Maximov is a very volume takedown-oriented guy, and he rolls well when it's on the mat, but against a guy like Cody Brundage, who has a similar type of wrestling background to a guy like Soriano, Brundage was able to defend all of the takedowns, and by the end of it in the third round, Brundage came on strong. So with a guy like Soriano, who is his cardio on the Brundage level? I would say no. Maximov, whose cardio, it all really depends. I'm just eager to see what we get out of a fight like this because it feels like an overcorrection in the style of opponent that Soriano is getting after his last fight.
Well, just for me, it's a weird placement on the card. Like you said, if this is the co-main event, I know we make fun of it sometimes about how they put unranked heavyweights, but even just think back at some of the unranked heavyweight co-main events. Like, Carlos Felipe versus Andre Arlovsky, for instance, like, it's not a great fight, but there's at least a bare-bones storyline there of you've got a prospect against the more established vet, and there's somewhat of a story to be told there. With Punahele Soriano versus Nick Maximov, like, I don't really know what either guy does off a win or off a loss, and honestly doesn't really do that much for either guy's career. Like, if Nick Maximov goes out there and submits Soriano in the first round, then yes, he is going to gain a lot of stock in people's eyes. But if Soriano goes out there and wins, I don't really think this does that much for his career.
Well, I mean, think of your last fight night co-main event. It was Jake Collier and Chase Sherman. So this is what the UFC is doing in 2022. So when I look at the odds for this, Soriano open to -170, is -198. If I look at it for Maximov, open to +145. He's +163. We look at the Tapology votes, 902 total votes, 75% Soriano, 75% have him to win by knockout. For the 25% that have Maximov, 58% by decision, 18% by submission, 13% by knockout. I think Soriano has a decided striking advantage in this one. And again, takedown defense aside from what it says on the UFC stats website, Soriano does have good takedown defense.
I'm going to say this, though. Nick Maximov in his UFC tenure is going to have one fight where he gets a submission in the first minute. I don't know what fight it's going to be, but there is going to be a fight where he goes out there, someone tries to take him down or vice versa, and he just scrambles into like a rear naked choke and wins quick. I don't know if this is going to be that fight, but that's the type of jiu-jitsu he has.
The other thing is, he's only 24, so the improvements are going to start to come with his boxing, and if I'm not mistaken, yeah, he's a guy that spent time at JUCO wrestling, so he does have that back in his back pocket. I just think Soriano has a good enough defensive awareness with his wrestling, maybe even shoots for his own takedowns. I would be surprised. But hey, Steven Peterson did it against Chase Hooper, so you never know. But I do have Punahou Soriano on this one.
I do too, but I will say this. If Nick Maximov does look like a more improved guy than the one who fought Cody Brundage, maybe he could have an interesting future in this division, because he does have such a specialty in his BJJ that if he is ever able to round out the rest of his game, then he could be a very dangerous fighter. So I think this will be a really fun fight, but I do have Punahou Soriano as well.
Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Are you going with the Nick Diaz Academy prospect in Nick Maximov to continue, keep that O in the loss column, or do you have Punahou Soriano, who had that O taken away from his last fight against Brendan Allen? We both do, and we got a big-time main event coming up between Jack Hermanson and Sean Strickland. If you missed any of the previous videos, maybe give them a shot and let us know, again, down below in the comment section, who you have in these fights. We love the back and forth down there. Greatest fans in the sports. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time main event coming up this weekend. We have Sweden's Jack Hermanson taking on Sean Strickland. Now, his nickname's Tarzan. I doubt he likes the song Tarzan Boy by Baltimore. Do I like it? Maybe I do. Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. Maybe there's some goofs, maybe there's some gaffes, and maybe we're talking Baltimore. You can find the man to my left, to your right, Matt Allen, on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. We make it pretty easy. And the fight that we have coming up this weekend is a fairly easy one to break down, because both of these guys have very different styles. I mean, with Jack Hermanson, he is able to get it done on the feet, but it is primarily his way to grapple you down to the mat. And whether it's by submitting his opponents or getting the win by ground and pound, he has a very lethal game. You have to remember, this is a guy that caused Jacare Souza problems on the ground before that was commonplace. He is a very, very special fighter, and it might surprise a lot of people to see that Sean Strickland has actually been in the UFC for longer than Jack Hermanson, has actually competed at middleweight before this big run that he's been on. He had a couple of fights at middleweight before he took his talents down to 170, ultimately lose to Santiago Ponzinibbio by decision. But if you look at the losses that he has at 170, Ponzinibbio, Kamaru Usman, and Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos, who put him on a poster, it has been an interesting ride. Now, for Strickland, he ends up losing that fight. He comes over to Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada, close to home for us, and he gets a win there, and that's where it really kind of kickstarted things. But that fight was at 170 that he was able to win in Moncton, and right after that fight against Nordin Taleb, he ends up getting in a really bad motorcycle accident. And it was a quote that he had that he left a piece of his kneecap on the road in that accident. He was out for a very long time, comes back at middleweight, takes on Jack Marshman, and has a heck of a performance. And since then, it's been night and day for Sean Strickland. He has really turned into a great pressure boxer, a great trash talker in the cage. And really, the negatives that I had about Sean Strickland, the fact that he is a little bit of square in his stance, hasn't come to bite him. And really, he is one of those guys that's heavy on his lead leg, but nobody's really caused him any issues with kicking it. So for Sean Strickland, he comes into his second main event in a row after a win over Uriah Hall by decision about 5 months ago, taking on Jack Hermanson, who is an interesting guy. Like, stylistically, this fight is very fun.
Sean Strickland to me is like seeing an ex-girlfriend on Instagram who's like doing really well for themselves after the fact, you know? Because like with Strickland, I counted him out. I thought he was what he was at 170. He wasn't going to make any improvements. He wouldn't change himself. And that was just going to be the person who we dealt with. And then I spent some time apart. I've went back. I've reevaluated. And Sean Strickland, at least now at 185, has really found his niche. And I like what he's been doing lately, because what he's been able to do is he's just accepted accentuated all the strengths he had at 170 pounds. And he must be one of those fighters where the weight cut is such a detriment on him, where immediately you're knocking off like 20% of his skills just due to the fact that he has to cut those extra 15 pounds. And the evolution, and I'm going to say evolution, he still fights in a very similar manner to the guy who fought at 170. He just fights with a lot more volume and a much higher sense of urgency. And that really has been the notice that I've seen out of Sean Strickland. It's almost a change in mentality more than anything. And I mean this in a great positive, because he's gone on such a run ever since he has shown a little bit more of himself, just really to the UFC audience. And I know he's a little out there with some of the stuff he does, but still, Sean Strickland in the cage has shown a lot of improvements, and that's what really matters at the end of the day. And the thing I like about Strickland too is we kind of thought we knew what fighter we saw at 170 pounds, but he has made those improvements and he's become a much better fighter. Like, he never had a main event when he fought at welterweight. There was never even conversations of Strickland getting into the top 15 at 170 pounds, but at 185, he's slowly been able to build his way up to the top of the division. And it's weird, and I'd love to get your opinion on this. I feel like one of his earlier wins at this division was his most impressive. I think the Brennan Allen win to this day is better than the Uriah Hall win. And let me defend it for this point, because I know the Uriah Hall win was 5 rounds. Uriah Hall didn't really show up in that fight, and with Uriah Hall, you kind of know. You either get the super dangerous version of him, or you don't really get the dangerous version of him. We knew what version we got that night, so to me, I look at what Strickland was able to do against the wrestling and the grappling of Brennan Allen, his ability to defend those takedowns and box him up on the feet, and I think that is a great precursor to this matchup against Jack Hermanson.
Well, if you look at it too, for Strickland in his fight against Christophe Jocko, a guy who he can fight on his back foot, this and that, he really did a great job and really was able to have that big uptick and not just aggression, but volume to get the win there. So a win over Jocko, a win over Allen. I don't put a lot of stock into that Uriah Hall fight other than the fact that, okay, it's 5 rounds. You're able to go a good 5 rounds, good hard 5 rounds. That's great. I think it's a little bit of revisionist MMA if we're looking at 170 pounds and saying, you know, about the rankings, because he was right up there. And you look at those losses. I mean, Usman, Ponzinibbio,
Eliseo Zaleski. Okay, but he was never in the rankings. He is now a ranked and a top-tier middleweight.
But for Strickland, the other thing too, again, first two fights in the UFC, those were at middleweight. He was also the King of the Cage middleweight champion coming in. He was undefeated, so on and so forth. Now we flip it on over to Jack Hermanson, who, yes, came into the UFC after Sean Strickland. But when you look at Jack Hermanson and you talk about some of those wins, the way that he was able to just beat David Branch, at the things that David Branch is very good at, taking him down to the mat, finishing him on the ground. You look at the fight against Gerald Meerschaert, submitting him in the first round, finishing Talis Laitis, that's not easy. Beating Brad Scott might be a little easier, beating Alex Nicholson, so on and so forth, but the run that Jack Hermanson's been able to go on is very impressive. Now, if we look at the losses, okay, Marvin Vettori, he got pressured. They had a great fight. A fight of the night caliber fight. But in that fight, it was Vettori pressuring forward, landing good volume, mixing in a little bit of the grappling, but really able to win out. And did Hermanson get hurt a little early in that fight? Man. He did get hurt. But still, losing to Jerry Cannonier is a bad one, especially that fight was in Denmark. You look at it for Hermanson, you'll see the flag of Norway, the flag of Sweden with him.
You bring up that loss, though, like it's a career ender. And I got to be honest, I disagree a little bit, because he lost by knockout to Jerry Cannonier. Who cares where it was? Like, I tried to bring up that point when Cyril Gane beat Derek Lewis, and you said it didn't matter where the fight was.
It's just, it is a bad one. You have a fight in Scandinavia, you lose that way, and then you come back and you beat Kelvin Gastelum. Now, that was a great one. Kelvin Gastelum's another one of those guys like Uriah Hall. Sometimes he's on, sometimes he's not. But in that one, credit where it's due, Hermanson's able to go in there, get that heel hook very quickly. So when it comes to this fight, Jack Hermanson is in an odd spot because he's ranked higher than Sean Strickland. We saw this. Calvin Kattar, when he's taking on Giga Chikadze. Chikadze was ranked lower, had all the hype and the steam. Kattar's able to come in and get the win. Now we have this fight where Sean Strickland kind of fights a little bit like Calvin Kattar with his pressure, with his boxing. He's got all the hype, and Hermanson is gotta, you know, he's gotta have one of those y'all must have forgot type performances, because his last time out, it's been a while. It was back in May of last year when he took on Edmund Shabazian, and, you know, first rounds are Edmund's forte, but after that, he usually doesn't win his fights.
I'll be honest, I think Sean Strickland's going to look great in this fight until he doesn't. I think Jack Hermanson at some point is going to get a 10-8 round. I could be wrong, but the way Jack Hermanson fights is, he's very hard to knock out. He is extremely durable. Only Jared Cannonier has been able to stop him. And his takedowns and ground and pound are some of the best in the UFC. He gets a lot of credit for his submission game, and he does have this really unique guillotine because it's an arm-in guillotine, but he's on the opposite side of the body. It's a very unique position to get in. It's how he beat both David Branch and Gerald Meerschaert. It's just just a unique submission he goes for a lot, and he almost got Jacare in it in the second round of their matchup. So he is very good on the ground, and I do think that at some point he's going to get Strickland down and really make him pay for it, because Strickland's ground game is unproven at this weight division. He's been able to pass sort of the wrestling defense skill checks up until this point, but with Hermanson, like, Edmund learned this trick the hard way. In the first round, yeah, these takedown attempts, I can defend them, I've got a bunch of strength. But Jack Hermanson has great cardio, and he's got great five-round cardio too, and those takedown attempts every round are going to get harder and harder and harder. And let's say Hermanson in the fourth round is able to get on top of Strickland. I do think Hermanson is the level of grappler to where he's really going to make Strickland pay for being on the bottom position. So for me, I think this fight comes down to how long do you think both fighters are going to be in their positions? Because Hermanson, I think, washes Strickland on the mat. I really do. And I don't think Strickland's a bad grappler by any means. It's just, if you want to give Jack Hermanson some Hall of Fame attributes, it would be his ground and pound and his own offensive game. So I don't think Strickland is going to be able to really compete with him a lot in the grappling. But on the feet, Hermanson has good volume, but he has awful striking defense. Like, his striking defense, to a large portion, is I'm going to throw so many punches that my opponent shells up, but once they're offensive themselves, he kind of finds himself in that position to where, oh, should I shell up? He's very unsure of himself in the striking, for lack of a better term, and I do think that's going to get him caught at a certain point. So no matter how much success I think Hermanson has on the mat, unless he gets, let's say, like three takedowns in the first round, and we can just tell from the first round, first 5 minutes, okay, Strickland can't defend the takedown attempts of Hermanson, then of course Hermanson's going to win. But I think this is going to be a very back and forth fight. I think it's going to look a lot like the Edmund Shabazian fight, but the difference is I think Strickland's going to be able to sustain his game a little bit longer.
The funny thing about this, I mean, you have Frontline Academy as the gym for Jack Hermanson. He obviously has great training partners over there. You look at it for Sean Strickland, the guy's kind of trained everywhere. Like, yes. Team Quest at the start, King's MMA, then he went to Syndicate. Ruka. Now for this one, it looks like he's at Extreme Couture with Eric Nixick. And then he posted a photo not that long ago on Instagram where he's like, yeah, I got a couple of Swedish guys that I'm training with getting ready for this fight. And one of them, Sadibu C.
Yeah, he was at Ruka with Bisping and Perillo too. Like, he really has jumped around a lot. And it is interesting. Like, with some fighters, we look at that as a great positive.
And then you see him knocking out training partners and then posting that it's cool.
I don't really care about that, to be honest, Craig. It's just, some guys, it does really affect them moving around training camps, because every training camp has a different philosophy. It's really hard for that fighter to be like, okay, what positives am I going to take from everybody? For Strickland, it has seemed to work so far.
And the weird thing is, and I bring this up because, again, the post out there, again, from the last couple of weeks where he's training with Sadibu C, all Sadibu C does is strike from long range. He's a good kickboxer, but he's a terrible wrestler. So it was a really kind of a head scratcher for me, other than the fact that you get to gauge his length, and that's about it for a fight like this. So I am interested to see Sean Strickland, because 82% takedown defense in the UFC, the last guy to take him down was Kamaru Usman, who got two of them. That was at UFC 210 in 2017. So it's been a while since anybody's taken down Sean Strickland in the octagon. If you look at it, since he's moved up to middleweight again, it's been Jack Marshman, striker, Brennan Allen, who can mix it up. You've got the man himself, Christoph Jocko, striker, Uriah Hall, striker, and Uriah Hall, again, was not on in that fight. So when it comes to this one, the odds, Strickland opened a minus 175 favorite. He is a minus 220 at this point. Jack Hermanson opened a plus 150. He's a plus 178. Matt, we talk about a matchup like this between, you know, a guy who strikes, doesn't really tend to grapple, in Sean Strickland. A guy who, Jack Hermanson, he can strike. And we saw him strike against Marvin Vettori for all five rounds. But he is very much adept with the bread and butter grappling that he brings to a game. So Matt, when it comes to a fight like this, we'll talk about the votes and the comments that are over in the YouTube community tab. But first, I'll throw it on over to you. You said, you know, Jack Hermanson, you wouldn't be surprised if he was able to get a 10-8, able to do a lot of work on the ground. But ultimately, does a first round really set the tone in this fight?
But yeah, of course. Though, we're going to know by the first takedown attempt from Jack Hermanson. I kind of set it up that way. Because if he takes Sean Strickland down with his first attempt, he'll be able to do it in the fifth round. Because I never look at Jack Hermanson and think, wow, that guy's really getting tired in this fight. It's like, even when he fought Marvin Vettori, who also has phenomenal cardio, I know he lost that fight. But like you said, it was a great fight. It was competitive. And in the fifth round, he was like hitting Vettori with some clean shots too. And they were going back and forth. So I think it will be a very competitive fight, even though it seems like it's being billed as, oh, this is just another chance for Sean Strickland to get closer to the top of the division. But it's interesting. Everything comes down to the takedown of Jack Hermanson. It really does.
1,500 total votes in the YouTube community tab. You folks voted for this one. 70% Sean Strickland, 30% Jack Hermanson. In the comments section, Cena is saying, Sean Strickland's striking is so crisp and his wrestling is pretty good. He is better than the Joker basically everywhere. Pretty hard to pick against him. Just hoping he wins and you get to see him and Izzy go at it at a press conference. That could be fun. Drew Cliff 82, who's out there in the comments section every week saying, this is a good one. Anxious to see how Sean... Yeah, those training partners. Strickland does against the top guys. I'm going Strickland because I believe he has better striking, good enough wrestling to keep it on the feet. John McCain is saying no clue what people are seeing in Strickland. Jack is a more crafty striker and better grappler. Plus, Jack has cardio for days. And Taylor Christian saying Jack by sub in round two. You heard it here first. So, Matt, 70% of the fans are on Sean Strickland. Does that surprise you? I know he's a decent favorite in this one.
You're dragging this out like it's an essay that you need 1,200 words for right now at the end. I think Sean Strickland's going to win, Craig.
Yeah, I think Sean Strickland's going to win as well. Now, Jack Hermanson, again, has a great ground game. But the trouble for me with Jack Hermanson in a matchup like this, he struggles against pressure strikers. He really does. And you brought it up. He's one of those guys that when he's defending against somebody who's boxing, I don't know if I keep my hands out here. I don't know if I bring my hands here.
Looks away from it almost.
He will look away. He just really, really struggles. And if you hit him with a hard right hand too, it really can be game over. Now, I know, again, it's really only happened against Jared Cannonier, but... against a guy like Sean Strickland, if Hermanson's able to pump his jab, throw a leg kick, get a takedown, it could be game over. I just have a hard time seeing that in this fight.
Who do you have?
Sean Strickland, I said it already.
You've passed it off to me like four times and I've said Strickland. Listen, if Hermanson gets the takedown, he can do a lot of damage. I just don't think he will. Sean Strickland's shown good takedown defense throughout his UFC career, and he is the vastly superior striker. And the thing about Strickland is, if he always fights at his pace while he goes downhill with his combo, he should be able to damage Hermanson enough throughout this fight to get it in the judges' scorecards.
Both of us going with Sean Strickland, but Jack Hermanson definitely with a great opportunity to get the win in this fight with some of the most lethal ground and pound and submission abilities on the mat in this middleweight division. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this fight, as well as the rest of the fights on this card. And make sure you tune in to Question Mark Kicks. That's QMK, 2 hours before the prelims on Saturday, when we get a final chance to offer up those picks and predictions with a look back at the week that was and the weigh-ins on Friday. So again, you're not going to want to miss that. We're shooting for 30,000 subs, so if you haven't subscribed already, it would mean a heck of a lot to us, because we're going to add a couple more wrinkles to the channel if we're able to pass that benchmark. I can't wait for the card coming up this weekend, so keep it locked in with Fightin' A Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.